You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
We've been living in a paranoid hallucination since 9/11. This illusory world in which we imagine that we're under attack from these very, very powerful enemies who were able to slaughter thousands of us on 9/11. And that's all, it's a Hollywood extravaganza. And yet that's the consensus reality of many people these days, because it took us too long to take apart what really happened on 9/11. It took years.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, False Flags, From Paris to San Bernardino. Kevin Barrett has taught Arabic, Islamic studies, folklore, African literature, French, and humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and San Francisco State University. He is one of the world's best-known Muslim critics of the War on Terror. He is the editor of three interfaith anthologies, 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, and his latest, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. He is the author of Truth Jihad and Questioning the War on Terror. Kevin Barrett, welcome again.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Bonnie.
I'm reading your new anthology, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. You have 27 contributing authors, and I must say some extremely informative and provocative analyses, not only on false flag events in Paris and San Bernardino, but of the war on terrorism, U.S. militarist factions, ISIS, the media, the New World Order, and on and on. I understand that you published this volume on the one-year anniversary of the Paris Charlie Hebdo attacks. Why that anniversary?
Well, I see these two Paris false flags of 2015 as being closely related. I was actually giving interviews in Paris about the events of January 7th in the Charlie Hebdo offices on the night before this new attack took place on Friday, the 13th of November. So I think there's clearly a link between the two. There's a decision here that was taken apparently to target Paris, and there are probably many, many reasons for that in geopolitics and military strategy. Typically, people try to achieve many different things with the same move, just like a good chess player will try to achieve many different things with the same move. But for me, you know, I love Paris. I lived there for a full year back in 1989. That's right. And so when these events happened in Paris, and especially when I was first taken in by the Charlie Hebdo shooting, I actually believed the official story for a little while. It kind of bothered me. You know, I guess Paris for me is linked with all of these images of a culture that's a little smarter, a little better educated than where I came from in the Midwest of the USA. So I just was offended that freedom, liberté, you know, which the French Enlightenment gave us, is being rolled back all over the planet. They're building a planetary gulag on the back of Islamophobia, and that Islamophobia is being created with these fake attacks attributed to so-called radical Muslims. And of course, they're also manufacturing real dangerous radical Muslims like ISIS. So the whole situation is very annoying to me. And I've been pushing back as hard as I can with these two books about the two big Paris false flags of 2015.
You begin the book with a series of articles that you wrote in response to and immediately following the Paris attack, in which so-called terrorist events were taking place simultaneously in three different locales in central Paris on Friday the 13th, November 2015. You were actually in Paris right before these series of events in November, isn't that right?
Yeah, I flew out on the afternoon of Friday the 13th, Paris time. And when my plane landed at Chicago's O'Hare Airport and we got to the luggage carousel, the TVs over the luggage carousel were full of news about this new big terror atrocity in Paris. So I guess I got out right before they locked down the borders. but yeah, you're right. There were drills going on that day. I didn't know that, of course, as I was flying out of Paris. But, you know, I actually went right by the Stade de France on the train to the De Gaulle Airport. And little did I suspect that as I was on my way out of Paris, there were all of these teams of whoever they are, Operation Gladio operatives, deep cover military people, maybe some crisis actors, all doing these drills that simulated exactly what happened. That is a multiple location active shooter event.
Well, that's very interesting, Kevin. I wasn't that aware of the drills. Of course, false flag events typically and almost always take place under the cover of drills, but I didn't realize that. Where did you read about the drills?
Well, there's a French doctor named Patrick Pelou, who was actually very much involved in the Charlie Hebdo affair as well. Apparently, he has a direct line to the president of France, and he called him up right away after this latest attack. Anyway, Pelou went on television on, I believe it was on the 13th or possibly the next day, and gave an interview in which he discussed the fact that he was participating in these multiple location active shooter terror exercises when the real thing suddenly broke out. Right on the same day. And so they had all of the emergency response prepared, and they just shifted seamlessly from the drill into the reality that was basically exactly the same as the drill.
Wow, that's a real dead giveaway. That reminds me of course, London 7-7, 9-11, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, Patrick Pelou is kind of the Peter Power of France. Peter Power is the Visor Consultants terror expert who went on television on 7-7. That is on July 7, 2005. The London bombings had just happened, and he went on television and said he was stunned that the actual attacks had happened at the precise locations and times that had been envisioned in the fictitious drills that his company had been hired to help arrange. Apparently nobody had explained to him that he shouldn't say things like that in public. So that's the most extreme example. But on 9/11, we also had 46 drills relating to 9/11, of which 20 odd were actually happening on September 11th, 2001, which was the biggest national security special event day in U.S. history. And those drills on 9/11 included live fly plane into building exercises, among others. They also included mock invasions from Russia that sent planes up to the North Pole so they wouldn't be in place to get in the way of whatever was happening on that day. And we've seen that, we see this over and over and over. Drills in San Bernardino as well, the follow-up to this most recent Paris attack. We had a facility targeted in San Bernardino, a facility for disabled people, which must be the only facility for disabled people in the world that has an active shooter drill every single month. And so when this actual event broke out at this facility, people there filmed it and just assumed it was a drill. So this pattern has become familiar to us now. It appears that the Operation Gladio false flag terror specialists are very much in the habit of creating drills that simulate the attacks that they're going to stage.
Do we have any specific information about the drills taking place in Paris on November 13th? I mean, for instance, I mean, there were three different locations there in Paris. There was the Stade de France that you mentioned you passed on your way out of town, etc. Do we know any specific locales where they were staging these drills?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I don't think so. This Pelou, I believe, kind of clammed up after he made his initial statements. It's possible that a little bit more is known at this point, but it seems that these drills are kept secret, you know, and of course the authorities have their reasons for that. They claim that all of this is part of the war on terror and has to be all veiled in secrecy. But no, I don't have details about precisely where these drills were happening.
You refer to the Charlie Hebdo attack on January 7th, 2015, as a Gladio II false flag. What do you mean by Gladio II? Are you referring to NATO?
Yes. Operation Gladio, the original version, was the wave of false flag terrorism that hit all over Europe during the Cold War. It included shootings in Brabant, Belgium, that killed more than a dozen people, I believe. There was the train station bombing in Bologna, Italy, and the depredations of the Baader-Meinhof gang and the Red Brigades in Italy. All of this, at the time, we were told, was an example of the left-wingers getting out of control. We were told there was a serious terror threat from the left, and that was one of the reasons that Europeans were reluctant to elect strong left-wing governments. Turned out that that was the whole purpose of the exercise. This Gladio wave of terror was being orchestrated by the Pentagon through NATO. NATO is really a euphemism for the U.S. military occupation of Europe. And the chiefs of NATO, that is, the people reporting to the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the American Pentagon, were employing so-called stay-behind armies, meaning a bunch of deep-cover mercenaries whose job originally had supposedly been to stockpile weapons and do military training in case the Russians ever invaded Europe. But that rationale quickly disappeared, and these assets were then used to terrorize Europe and falsely blame left-wingers in order to prevent Europeans from electing left-wing governments. And it worked famously. They were able to keep their control of Europe and avoid any of these independent left-wing parties from taking over any European countries. And instead, we had parties like the French Socialist Party, which was actually created by the CIA, the pseudo-left-wing parties, taking power. So that was the original Operation Gladio. And now we're in the middle of, I guess you could call it Gladio II. And this is this new permutation of the wave of false flag terror sponsored by Western insiders. And this time, of course, it's all targeting Muslims, or rather, Muslims are the patsies who are set up to be blamed for these attacks. It actually began before September 11th, 2001. It appears that the earlier World Trade Center bombing in 1993 was false flag. The FBI built the bomb, and we know that because the FBI informant who had orchestrated that bombing taped himself discussing with his handler from the FBI how the FBI was supposed to have given him a dud, but didn't, apparently. And he was very upset about that because a lot of people got killed. So that was one example. We had the USS Cole bombing, which was attributed to a disabled teenager in a dinghy, but which was probably actually a bomb planted inside the ship. And that's precisely what the government of Yemen said at the time. They investigated, and their report said that this was done by the Americans themselves, and so on and so forth. We had African embassy bombings as well. This whole wave of terror attributed to Muslims has been essentially fabricated by the same people who fabricated the Brabant shooting and the Bologna bombing, the killing of Aldo Moro, and the other high-profile atrocities of the Cold War in Europe. So it seems that the United States government and its deep state organized crime assets seem to have some kind of need to create mayhem in Europe. And now, of course, it's spread all over the West and all over the world. It's created a clash of civilizations between the West and the Islamic world. And unless people wake up a little faster than they are right now, it could continue for quite some time.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, False Flags from Paris to San Bernardino. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. There were three different locales in central Paris on November 13th where shootings ostensibly took place: La Belle Equipe restaurant, the Bataclan nightclub, and the Stade de France. Many questions have arisen as to what actually took place at these three different locations. Are there eyewitness reports to what happened?
Yes, there are. Well, you know, that there are, but there are also not nearly as many photographs and videos as one might expect, especially at the Belle Équipe and at the Bataclan nightclub. And it's kind of hard to tell which witness reports are credible. For instance, immediately after the events, we heard on Fox News that the perpetrators in the Bataclan nightclub had been shouting about Syria and so on. We got as supposed eyewitness reports that turned out not to be true. The same reports on Fox News told us that some of the perpetrators had been arrested, and that was not the official story the next day. So there were a number of dubious initial reports. And these dubious initial reports all seem to emphasize the connection with Syria. Later, there have been other reports, and some of the other reports, eyewitness reports, have diverged significantly from the official story in various ways. For example, at the Belle Équipe restaurant, we learned from eyewitnesses reported in the mass media that the shooters were actually white paramilitary types, large, very well-muscled white paramilitary types, which does not jibe with the descriptions of the people that the French government would later blame. So there's a kind of a mishmash of eyewitness reports, including various kinds of details that both fit with and don't fit with the official story. But there's kind of a shocking lack of photo and video evidence in an era in which practically everybody is walking around with a smartphone that can take very high quality pictures. There's very, very little publicly available anyway on this. And you would think there would be more, because you would kind of think that people could make money selling it to the media, for one thing. And certainly people do have a tendency to share everything that they film these days. So it's interesting, for example, that the only photo or video evidence we have of any dead bodies in the Bataclan nightclub is this really strange image that is reproduced on the cover of the book, Another French False Flag. This image appears to have been sort of taken from a high vantage point. It shows bodies on the floor of it's the dance floor of this nightclub. And there are red smears surrounding these bodies in the shape of a heart. And one has to wonder what created those smears. One could imagine very, very bloody bodies being dragged around the floor to paint this sort of heart shape on the floor. But why would they do that? And there's actually probably too much blood. And there are other questions about this picture as well. A couple of the bodies seem to be anatomically impossible in terms of the positions that they're in. These positions would be possible if what we're being told our bodies were in fact dapper cadavers, which are fake bodies sold to Hollywood and to others who, you know, have a use for fake bodies. I suppose drills would use them as well. So there are a whole lot of questions about the witness reports, both the ones that seem reliable and the ones that have been proven false. But the biggest question to me so far is really the lack of photo documentation. At the Belle Équipe, for example, nobody got a picture of this car with the three white paramilitary guys. Nobody got the license plate. One would really think that there would be a lot more of that. And who knows, you know, whether people in Paris who are investigating this, and there are a couple of, you know, a handful of alternative journalists who are brave enough to take this stuff on, will perhaps shed more light on this as time goes on.
You mentioned this extremely strange picture from the Bataclan nightclub, a portion of which, like you say, appears on the cover of your new anthology. If people want to look at this picture, where can they find it? Is it available?
Well, most of the versions of it on the internet are not in the highest resolution that we have. But I guess if you feed into a search engine like Google Images, Bataclan nightclub, you know, bodies, French terror attacks, things like that, you'll probably find it. And if you look around for a while, you might find the higher resolution versions and the ones that haven't had various kinds of masking put over the bodies and things like that. It is a fairly horrific image, but it really does raise questions. And one of the questions is, are they messing with us? I mean, why would they just leave these bodies there? You know, there's no medical attention, nothing like that. And what painted this heart-shaped smear with these, you know, 6 foot wide smears of blood or whatever that red stuff is that they painted the heart on the floor of the nightclub with? Precisely what is going on with this? And I've discussed this with various people with some law enforcement and military backgrounds, and they have thrown up their hands and said this picture doesn't make any sense.
Now, you've also mentioned the lack of photographic evidence in general. I mean, with the exception of the strange and sort of grisly photograph that we've been discussing, are there any other photos at all of these three simultaneous shootings in Paris?
Well, yeah, sure, there are. And there are some videos as well. I think there's some videos of people fleeing the nightclub and things like that. But not a lot. It's kind of shocking how few there are. You know, one would think that in the nightclub itself there would be some photos and videos. But what we have is that crazy picture that we've been discussing of the heart painted in blood on the dance floor with the dapper cadavers or the bodies in very unusual positions arranged. And then we also have a very famous, iconic photo that was supposedly taken right before the shootings, taken from the band the Eagles of Death Metal as they were playing from their vantage point, showing the crowd dancing to the music. And that's a very, very high quality picture. Some say it looks a little too high quality. There's been a discussion of whether that photo is authentic or not. And I didn't include the people saying it's not authentic in the book, because I looked at that back and forth discussion, and when people like Massimo Mazzucco, a former professional photographer, who's quite a skeptic on false flags, looked at this, he said that photo was probably real. So in any case, there's that iconic photo of the audience. There's the iconic photo that I just mentioned of the heart painted in blood on the dance floor with bodies strewn around. And then there are these sort of a handful of these things of, you know, people fleeing from the nightclub and things like that, but not very much. I mean, there's you can't look around and find, you know, dozens or hundreds. And you kind of think you would. You certainly think that you would find people would have taken stuff on their iPhones from inside the nightclub during the show, during the shooting. How could nobody take any photo? I mean, sure, they're trying to save themselves, but there are a few thousand people in there. Of all those people, you'd think a couple would have taken some shots and they'd be worth a lot of money and they would go to the media, but there's nothing. So it's a bit of a mystery, and whether that will all get cleared up and maybe some photos will emerge in the future, it's a possibility. I don't know.
Who is Mohamed Boutiche and why is he important?
Well, Mohamed Boutiche, as I recall, was the acquaintance of the Kouachi brothers, who were the patsies blamed for the Charlie Hebdo event. And there were all sorts of questions about those guys, beginning with the fact that the Interior Minister, Bernard Cazeneuve, on the very day of the Charlie Hebdo attacks on January 7th, 2015, Cazeneuve said that there were three terrorists in the Charlie Hebdo offices. And the official story and all of the supporting evidence only shows two. What made him think there were three? Well, a third later popped up. You know, 2 days later, a third guy, Koulibaly, took hostages in the kosher deli. So there are all sorts of questions about these Kouachi brothers that were blamed for shooting up the Charlie Hebdo offices. Among them, if indeed they were members of Al-Qaeda in Yemen and other terror groups, why would the French police hunt them down like dogs and execute them rather than making some effort to capture them alive and interrogate them and take down their networks? And it turns out that maybe the reason that the French police had no interest in capturing these brothers alive was that the Kouachi brothers were working for French intelligence. And so we got word from Mohamed Boutiche, among others, that there are actually eyewitnesses, including him, to the fact that these guys were intelligence assets. And we have a lot of reasons for thinking that. They made all sorts of impossible journeys to the Middle East, for example, going to Israel and then to countries where you can't go if you have an Israeli stamp in your passport, among other things. All sorts of very improbable aspects of their biographies. And one of them, for example, is that the Kouachi brothers were arrested with child pornography MMM was just dropped. They were never prosecuted. And in such a situation, when you have two guys like this who are close to supposed radical Islamist currents, you can be sure that those guys became intelligence assets, and that's why those charges went away. So anyway, Boutish apparently had firsthand knowledge that the Kouassi brothers were intelligence assets, and he was arrested a few months ago, actually a little bit before this latest false flag. And according to some of his friends and supporters in France, they're trying to silence him, and they're trying to prevent him from publicly affirming his firsthand knowledge that the Kouassi brothers were French intelligence assets.
You're listening to the voice of Dr. Kevin Barrett. I am Bonnie Faulkner. Today is a fundraiser for KPFA, and as you may have guessed, we're offering as a premium today a couple of premiums, two blockbuster anthologies by Dr. Kevin Barrett. His very newest one that we're focusing on in this interview, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. This is about 338 pages, I believe, 27 contributing authors. It's a blockbuster, highly, highly recommended. Another French False Flag, our gift to you today on KPFA for a donation to Free Speech Radio of $100. We also have Kevin Barrett's prior anthology, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, an excellent, excellent anthology, again with an array of top-notch authors, that for $100 to KPFA. I'd love to get a few of you on the phone to support free speech. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Your $100 tax deductible contribution will get you either his latest, Another French False Flag, about the Paris attacks and also the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino. But this latest anthology with 27 contributors covers a broad territory. A lot of the articles are specifically on these terror events. Many of the articles are on the larger geostrategic military plans of the elites. Some people speculate on where this is all headed. There are some incredible authors. Of course, Paul Craig Roberts is in here, Brandon Martinez, Nick Kohlerstrom, A Paris Again Hit by Fictional Terror. That's a very interesting one about these events being presaged on the cover of The Economist, What to Expect in 2015. We've got article, another Anatomy of a False Flag by Stephen Lendman, on and on and on. Gerard O. Coleman, a young Marxist, lives in Paris. He's from Ireland. James Petras is in here. Wars, U.S. Militarist Factions in Command. Barry Kissen. We've got many people. Ken O'Keefe, Jim Fetzer, Alain Sorrell, you name it. James Tracy, Ola Damigard, Henry Macau, on and on. This incredible anthology, highly recommended. Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. A $100 donation. We would be delighted to send you this. Also, we've got We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11. You just heard Kevin Barrett discussing the person that has been arrested and in jail because he is witness to the fact that the Kouassi brothers were working for French intelligence. We've got a whole anthology on Charlie Hebdo. Very well done. Barbara Honecker has written a blockbuster chapter for this book. Kevin Barrett again, Anthony Hall, Webster Tarpley's in the We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. He's a favorite. Paul Craig Roberts again, Elaine Sorrell. Let's see, who else? My gosh, just about a whole laundry list of people. Cynthia McKinney, Barry Chamish, Ola Damigard again, and on and on. That also for a $100 contribution to Free Speech Radio KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 5732, 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Each book, a $100 tax-deductible contribution to Free Speech Radio, and, of course, a $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA for a year and entitles you to vote in our local station board elections. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. I can't recommend these books highly, highly enough. Now, because today is a fundraiser, I'm not going to be able to play the entire blockbuster interview with Kevin Barrett. It builds and builds and builds to an incredible crescendo. But I am happy to let you know that probably by this evening, I'll have the entire show up on gunsandbutter.org. Tony Rango's been out of town on a business trip, but he's coming back today, and so he'll put the show up for you if you want to hear the whole thing at gunsandbutter.org. 1-800-439-5732, $100 for either one of the anthologies, edited by Dr. Kevin Barrett. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. We want to play a little bit more of this interview with Kevin today. Oh, I don't want to forget that we could use a few more of you in the pledge room. There were a few people when I came in, but we can always use a few more. At 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, right in Berkeley. So come on down if you've got some free time and you'd like to socialize down here at KPFA and help us answering the phones. 1-800-439-5732. Speaking of the phones, and if you've never done it before, it's a lot of fun. And if you want to come down, the people in the pledge room will train you how to do that. So let's see, Erica, maybe we should go back and hear a few more minutes of this interview with Kevin Barrett. You mentioned two writers who have contributed to this anthology who write that the Charlie Hebdo event had a prequel and a sequel with similar scripts and themes, i.e. the Mohammed Mera affair and the Copenhagen attacks. On December 2, 2015, there was news of 14 people being killed and more than 20 injured in a shooting at Inland Regional Center, a facility for disabled people in San Bernardino, California. You describe San Bernardino as a sequel to the Triple Paris attacks. Are there similarities in script and theme this time around? And are the script and themes the same or different from the Charlie Hebdo attacks?
Well, I think we've seen a shift, Bonnie. I think that in the Charlie Hebdo attacks, which had a prequel, which was the Mohammed Mera shooting, and then they had a sequel, which was the Copenhagen attacks, we saw exactly the same pattern with all three events. In all three events, there was a two-part attack, and the first part targeted a national symbol or free speech, and then the second part targeted Jews. In the case of Mohammed Mera, which was a couple of years before Charlie Hebdo, somebody supposedly shot up some French soldiers, and then somebody supposedly shot up a Jewish school. And the same guy, Mohammed Mera, was blamed for both events, but he certainly didn't do them because eyewitnesses reported that the actual shooters of the French soldiers had white power tattoos. Obviously, it wasn't Mohammed Mera. In any case, so they're a two-part attack. First part targets French soldiers, then they target a Jewish school. With the Charlie Hebdo events, the first part targeted free speech, namely the cartoonists. The second part targeted the kosher deli, that was its Jews. And then in Copenhagen, we had the same thing. We had the first attack targeted a free speech event celebrating anti-Islam cartoonists. And then the second part targeted a synagogue. So in all three of these events, we had exactly the same script, you know, two dubiously linked attacks. The first one targets a national symbol or free speech. The second one targets some kind of Jewish target. And I think that the reason for that probably was, of course, to reinforce the same thing that we heard, or rather that the police in New York heard on 9/11 when they arrested the Israeli spies who were caught dancing and celebrating the success of the attacks. Were found to have thousands of dollars in cash stuffed in their socks, working for a moving company, was well known to be a Mossad front, Urban Moving Systems, run by Dominic Suter. Man, the FBI even put out warrants on as a terrorist. These guys, when they were arrested by the New York police, for, you know, being Mossad agents celebrating the success of their operation when the Trade Center was blown up. These guys told the police, we're not your problem. The Palestinians are your problem and our problem. We have the same problem. And that's the theme of the war on terror, is that the Israelis have the same enemy as the West. Now, it's true that the Israelis do have a local Arab Muslim enemy. They've gone and, you know, ethnically cleansed, arguably committed genocide in the heartland of Islam, the holy land that's been Islamically administered ever since Islam began, with a couple of brief crusader interludes 1,000 years ago. So the Israelis do have a problem with quote-unquote Islamic terrorism. That is, Muslims support the Palestinian liberation struggle, and Israel faces a very troubled and dubious future. But the West does not have any problem whatsoever with Islam. There's no such problem. The Islamic world has been the ally of the West in the struggle against communism during the Cold War, and, you know, for better or worse. So anyway, the war on terror is really all about trying to brainwash the Western public into believing that the actual enemies of Israel are, in fact, also enemies of, quote unquote, the West, which they are not. So that's the script overall for this war on terror. We saw that on 9/11 with those Israeli spies arrested saying it. And that was the theme that was hammered home with those three events in a row, two in France and then one in Copenhagen last year.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, False Flags from Paris to San Bernardino. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So now we're in a slightly different mode, I think, with this new Paris attack and the follow-up or the sequel in San Bernardino. Here, rather than having the victims of the attack being people that Muslims might conceivably have some kind of hatred for, like the French military in the Mohammed Merah event, like the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists in that event, or like the anti-Islam cartoonists in Copenhagen, now we're seeing these supposed radical Muslims attacking people pretty randomly, people that no radical Muslim would ever really have any problem with. In Paris, these recent attacks targeted people at a soccer match, people at a rock concert, and people at a restaurant. So a nightclub, a restaurant, a soccer match. And these were basically middle-class, educated, mostly white French young people in the Paris attack. And then there were disabled people targeted in San Bernardino. Interestingly, the precise demographic that was targeted in Paris is the demographic that has been leading France towards a more and more pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli policy. So by targeting that demographic and ascribing the attacks to radical Muslims, this is turning around the political dynamic in France, is steering it away from its turn towards Palestine and away from Israel. So I think that's the new pattern with these two attacks. And I think the San Bernardino attack was maybe partly done to bring the U.S. into the picture, because these Paris attacks have been propagandizing the U.S. Americans notice when something terrible like this happens in Paris. They don't notice when it happens in a place like Nigeria, where far more people have been killed in much bigger terror attacks, but nobody even blinks here, or in Syria or in so many other places around the world. But Paris, yes, the Americans will notice it. And so then if you stage a follow-up shortly after the big Paris attack in November, stage a follow-up in early December in San Bernardino, that gets the Americans and sort of the West as a whole dragged into it. But again, targeting disabled people who've never done radical Muslims any harm whatsoever, targeting young, educated French people who have been pushing their country to become more and more pro-Palestinian, this would make no sense whatsoever from any strategic standpoint of actual radical Muslims, but it makes a lot of sense from the strategic standpoint of the Zionists who want to drag the West into a war on Islam for Israel.
Did the alleged Islamic terrorists in the San Bernardino attacks have any odd connections to Israel?
Well, indeed they did. Let's see. It was the brother, I think. You know, I don't have the precise details in front of me right now, but to the best of my recollection, the couple that was blamed for the San Bernardino attack, falsely, in my judgment, had a close family relationship with a pair of Russian-Israeli sisters. And the speculation there has not been confirmed that there was an intelligence connection. We don't know for sure, but it's interesting how these kinds of Israeli connections kind of keep popping up with these events. Over and over and over, we find some sort of Israeli connection. Just for example, with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, we had the alleged radical Muslim terrorists fleeing the Charlie Hebdo offices, where they just shot a bunch of cartoonists, we're told, and they fled in their getaway car straight to the center of the radical pro-Israeli part of Paris, the center of the Jewish quarter of Paris, and they dropped off their getaway car and then conveniently apparently happened to lose their identification card, which we're told is the only reason they were caught, because they dropped their ID card in the abandoned getaway car. They did this right in front of Patisserie Restaurant, which is the local Paris headquarters for the Jewish Defense League, which is considered a terrorist group here in the U.S. And every year, the Patisserie hosts a huge celebration for the Israeli Defense Forces. So we're told that the radical Muslim terrorists chose the exact spot, right in front of the place where they have a huge celebration of the IDF every year, to drop off their abandoned getaway car, throw their ID cards down, and carjack a new car and drive away. What a strange place to do that. And so likewise, when we have this sudden close family connection to a couple of very dubious looking Russian Israeli women, it does make us scratch our heads.
The reason I brought that up, Kevin, is I happened to read on the Daily Mail that long article about these sisters. So it was just kind of a coincidence that I had happened to see that article on the Daily Mail, which is a tabloid site, but every now and again they'll have something quite interesting on there. So I tend to check it out once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. I believe the Daily Mail also covered the whole controversy during the Charlie Hebdo attack, or rather the aftermath, about the whole issue of Shab, the editor of Charlie Hebdo, supposedly had this girlfriend, Jeanette Bougrabe. And immediately after the attack, the whole world was treated to these images of Jeanette Bougrabe, who's a former minister from the Sarkozy extreme Zionist government, publicly and histrionically lamenting the loss of the love of her life, Sharp, the editor of Charlie Hebdo. But suddenly we learn, thanks to these tabloids like the Daily Mail, that all of Sharp's family was denying that there had been any such relationship and that Jeanette Bougrabe was barred from his funeral. So, you know, sometimes this kind of truth emerges best in the tabloids.
Yeah, that's right. The attorney in the San Bernardino shooting case has stated that the government's case does not add up. What is some of the credible evidence so far that negates the official narrative of what happened there? You list 10 obvious points that don't add up.
Right. Well, I was very pleased to see that finally we have a defense attorney willing to stand up and question the official story that supposedly implicates his clients. We haven't seen very much of that in the past. In particular, in the Boston case, it's just really sad that we have an innocent man condemned to death because his lawyer sold him out. But here in the San Bernardino case, we had a very brave lawyer who stood up and said, this case doesn't add up. And among the things that he questioned were the whole story of how this couple supposedly died in the shootout. You know, we're told that the couple blamed for the shooting in San Bernardino, you know, shot at police first. And yet their windows were rolled up. The car has had its windows blasted out, but they were rolled up. So how did these people initiate a gun battle through rolled up windows, or carry out a gun battle through rolled up windows? And the pictures of them dead show them in handcuffs. One might surmise that what really happened was they were just executed as police unleashed a barrage of fire through the windows of their car. And perhaps they were already in handcuffs at that point. Who knows? There's that aspect. And another aspect of this, and I think maybe the most important, is that we have multiple credible eyewitness reports that the actual shooters in this facility for disabled people, it wasn't a couple. It wasn't this Muslim couple that they blamed. It was three, not two, but three large white paramilitaries. And, you know, if you hear that from one witness, that's interesting. And, you know, hear it from two witnesses, it's a lot more than interesting. And I think we have three now, which to my mind is kind of pretty much a dead giveaway. And, you know, whether this attorney's team has been warned to stop poking around in this stuff, I don't know. But it certainly was very curious how we were told that the couple initiated a gun battle and died, yet they did this through rolled up windows, and that the witnesses who saw the actual shooting say it was three large white paramilitaries.
Well, Kevin, you also point out in your articles in the book, if the couple was really part of a terrorist network, would the FBI have let the media ransack the crime scene? The internet was filled with the mass media going through these people's house.
Yes, that was very strange, wasn't it? We're told that this couple was linked to two, not just one, but two radical Islamist terror networks. And so once again, let me emphasize, they should have been captured alive if that were the case. I believe that to prevent further atrocities, it would be worth taking extraordinary risks to make sure they were captured alive if they were really the kind of terrorists we're told they were. Instead, they were apparently executed, it looks like, by police. And then we were treated to this outrageous spectacle 2 days later of the crime scene, that is the apartment of this couple that was being blamed for this mass murder, being ransacked by media. And just hangers-on, a crowd of random people followed some media people into their apartment. The landlord opened it up. There's no police tape, no crime scene tape, no securing the crime scene, nothing like that. And so they just barged into their apartment and started, you know, grabbing a Quran and holding it up to the cameras. Oh, see, they must have been radical Muslims. They had a Quran and things like this. Totally disturbing all of the evidence, assuming there was actually evidence there of any kind of crime. And many have argued, and I would agree with them, that if this were really the kind of terrorist crime that we were told it was, that wouldn't have happened. None of this would have happened this way. They would have tried to capture the terrorists alive and question them and take down their network. They would have secured the apartment very, very carefully. I mean, who knows what might be in there that could tie in to these radical terror networks. But apparently the authorities, the FBI, I guess, in this case, allowed the media and a bunch of people whose identities we don't even know, just random people from the neighborhood maybe, to go into that apartment and just tear it apart a couple of days after the crime. So this is a huge red flag.
That's the voice of Dr. Kevin Barrett talking to me, Bonnie Faulkner, about the San Bernardino attacks. We're actually talking about his new anthology, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. This is our thank you gift today for a $100 tax-deductible donation to Free Speech Radio KPFA. You're not going to hear this kind of analysis or hear about these kind of books on any other network other than Pacifica. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. To support the work of Dr. Kevin Barrett, to support this station, to keep us on the air. Very, very important to do that. In a couple of minutes, I've got, only maybe 12 minutes to go. I'm going to bring Dr. Barrett back on and let him talk a little bit about this book that we're offering today for a $100 donation, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. Now, you just heard Dr. Barrett deconstructing the evidence in the San Bernardino shooting case. And it's interesting how these terrorist events will slop over into all other areas of our life. In the news today, I read that the U.S. government is challenging Apple because they want Apple's encryption information so that they can get into the new iPhones, and they are using the San Bernardino shooting as a reason. Donald Trump has come out and supported this and said, oh, yes, Apple should turn over all of their encryption information, which would jeopardize the security of Apple users. Turn it all over to the government. Apple CEO Tim Cook is fighting this. He's so far he has resisted this intrusion into every single little corner of our lives. That's where the government wants to go. And these terrorist events, these affect us in all kinds of ways. 1-800-439-5732. Please show your support right now for Free Speech Radio KPFA. $25 contribution makes you a member for a year. You can vote in our local station board elections. Very, very important. $100, we can send you this incredible book. Highly recommended. I am reading it. There are some blockbuster essays in here. I'm going to bring, I had Dr. Barrett record a little four-minute description of the book so you get an idea of what we're offering you. We also have another book. Oh, this is an incredible book. We're Not Charlie Hebdo, Free Thinkers Question the French 9/11. That is an anthology as well. It is very good. A case is made about the Charlie Hebdo event being a false flag. That also for a $100 contribution. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Obviously, this is Guns and Butter. Comes to you every Wednesday from 1 to 2 on KPFA. And as I mentioned before, briefly, we will have the entire interview with Kevin up on gunsandbutter.org by tonight. Yaro Mako, of course, has done a great job. He's working away on these shows, working on the audio, mixing them, putting them up every week so you can hear them here on KPFA. Well, you know, Erica, I think let's play Dr. Barrett's short description of the contents of our premium today, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. Well, Kevin, could you say a little bit briefly about a few of the authors that have contributed to your new anthology, Another French False Flag?
Well, sure. We have 27 total contributors, of whom I believe 9 are Muslim. We have 2 former CIA officers, Philip Giraldi and Robert David Steele. And we have a number of professors, current professors, retired professors. And we even have, let's see, I think 4 total former professors who were chased out of the academy for investigating things that the powers that be didn't want investigated. You know, moving to the CIA veterans, I think they're a couple of the most interesting contributors here. Philip Giraldi is a former CIA officer who actually helped me put together a piece of his. It's actually kind of a combination of 2 pieces that he'd done, one in the New York Times and one in the American Conservative magazine. And so he kind of fleshed that out and, you know, changed it a little bit. And so what we ended up with was this really good article talking about false flags in general and the Israeli false flag aspect of 9/11 in particular. And this is coming from a guy who was on the inside of the CIA. Same thing with Robert David Steele. He starts his piece by saying that, hey, I used to run false flags for the CIA. And so I know these things are real from personal direct experience. And he says, I just can't believe that so many people roll their eyeballs when they hear me say things like these Paris events look like false flags. You know, the guy who actually ran false flags as his job for the CIA is now stunned at the inability of his countrymen to understand that false flags are a normal part of standard operating procedure for people in that community. So those are some of the interesting former, you know, intelligence guys. But we have a number of other really interesting contributors. Gerard O'Coleman did a great commentary from Paris right after the attacks happened in November. And that was viewed by over 1 million people. I think it's up to 2 million or so now. And he, of course, expressed skepticism about the official scenario. We have Ken O'Keefe, the hero of the Mavi Marmara incident, James Petras, one of the world's leading sociologists, Paul Craig Roberts, the man who invented Reaganomics and is now somewhat only about half apologetic for that. He says the world has changed and he's really come over to the left side of the analysis. But Paul Craig Roberts is one of the most illustrious people in the world. He's on the who's who list of the 100 most influential people in the world. We have Anthony Hall from University of Lethbridge, who's been doing really good work on false flags, 9/11, and so on. Gilad Atzmon, the ex-Israeli skeptic of Zionism, who's in this book actually questioning some of my arguments about false flags. Stephen Lenman, great guy. He's from a Jewish background, as are several other contributors. He's kind of come around to seeing things from more or less the same viewpoint that I do. And we even have the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran in this book, Ayatollah Khamenei. He's one of the very few world leaders who's willing to stand up and speak the truth about these covert operations. I think it's wonderful to find this kind of diversity of voices, all of whom are saying that we really need to sit down and think harder about these iconic terror events that shape our consciousness.
Well, there you have it, a brief description of the book we're offering today for a $100 tax-deductible donation to Free Speech Radio KPFA, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. 27 contributors. I've been reading some of these articles. Wow, there are some very outlandish ones, too. It's kind of nice, I was telling Kevin, that he includes a broad spectrum of opinion, no holds barred. So we've got to look at these events very closely and not hold back. 1-800-439-5732, $100 for either book. We are not Charlie Hebdo. Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, an excellent anthology. Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. And we have two anthologies today as thank you gifts for a pledge of $100 for either one. 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to thank a few of the people that have called in to support this show, to support free speech. I'd like to thank Mark Gerolimov in Santa Clara. Thank you, Mark. Albert Dragstad in Oakland. Hey, Albert, thank you very much. I saw your wife wandering around the KPFA Crafts Fair. I didn't see you there, though, but thank you for your support. Thank you to Mark Batchelder in San Anselmo. He called in 1-800-439-5732 to pledge his tax-deductible financial support to Free Speech Radio KPFA. I'd also like to thank Tom Thoreau in Hay Fork, California. How about that? I'm going to have to find out where Hay Fork is. Thank you to Robert Manzando. Thank you, Robert. He's in Fresno. And, of course, Robert's contribution will go to the Fresno station, 88.1. I listen to that when I'm driving down Highway 5. But Fresno station, of course, carries much of the content here on KPFA. So thank you, Robert. Also, thank you to Karen Walter in San Rafael. You can join these contributors, these supporters of free speech, by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation makes you a member, enables you to vote in our local station board elections, which we're finally having them again. Very important. $100, you can choose either book. Of course, if you can afford $200, that would be great support. You could have both books. They're both blockbuster anthologies, both edited by Dr. Kevin Barrett. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I want to thank Tony Rango for all of his great work on the Guns and Butter website, gunsandbutter.org. You'll have this show in its entirety up tonight. And, of course, all the great work of Yara Mako. He's been with me from the very, very beginning. So we're very thankful. If you want to get a hold of me, shoot me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. And one last time, I want to give out that phone number, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Thank you so very much for your contributions. We will talk to you next week.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Joseph Stiglitz returns with part two of a fine talk on our growing economic inequality. It's bad for the people, it's bad for the economy, and the 1% are trying very hard to make the problem even worse. I hope you'll stay tuned. Economist Joseph Stiglitz is a card-carrying member of the establishment, but the liberal wing of the establishment. I think that, like Franklin Roosevelt, he's trying to save capitalism from itself, not trying to overthrow it. Okay, fair enough. What he offers is a brilliant analysis of exactly what is going wrong with the economy, what is causing it to go wrong, and who is benefiting from the sufferings of so many others. The last question is an easy one. Stiglitz himself says, we have an economic system, quote, of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%, unquote. Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and others have been saying words like this for years. But it's bracing to hear the same also from a distinguished mainstream source. Stiglitz's resume includes stints as the chairman of the President's Council on Economic Advisers, as chief economist of the World Bank, as recipient of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science. When he says the system is nuts, it really is nuts. And he explains the problems very well indeed. This is an archival recording. Stiglitz spoke in 2012. I've cut out a number of stumbles and hesitations, but apart from that, not a word needed to be changed. Today, we'll hear the conclusion of Stiglitz's talk, and then a selection from the Q&A that followed. The title of the presentation is How Inequality in Today's Society Endangers Our Future. Joseph Stiglitz.
I want to spend just a few minutes trying to explain why America's inequality is so bad for our economy and our growth. It's bad for our politics. It has a lot of adverse effects. But in the narrow sense, you know, not looking at this from a moral point of view, just looking at it from an economic point of view, it's bad. The first reason is that this kind of inequality is associated with more instability and a weaker economy. It's not an accident that the last time inequality reached a level that is comparable to what we have today was in 1929, right before the Great Depression. And the reason for this, let me try to explain it very quickly. The people at the top save a significant fraction of their income, 15, 20%. The people at the bottom can't. They spend all their money. So when you redistribute money from the bottom to the top, you reduce demand. Now, the response of the Fed ignored what was going on and said, oh, I know how to keep demand going. Let's create a bubble. Now, of course, they didn't say it quite that way. What they did is they got rid of regulations. They had a flood of liquidity, and that did create the bubble. And it kept the economy going in spite of the fact of the low demand that was arising from the growing inequality. It worked, but only temporarily. And that was predictable, and it was predicted. And, of course, now we're dealing with the aftermath. But part of that aftermath is that we still have the degree of inequality, but we don't have the bubble. And that means that our economy is lacking effective demand, aggregate demand, and that means there's going to be high levels of unemployment persistently. Some of the other reasons that inequality is bad for our economy and for economic growth follow very much from the analysis of the sources of inequality. You know, I talked about one of the sources of inequality is the extensive rent seeking. And as I said, the nature of rent seeking is that you're trying to get more money from others rather than adding to the wealth of the society. And so you're diverting resources to speculation, to try to persuade Congress to give you a gift rather than using it more productively. In fact, I mean, one as a teacher at Columbia and all when I talk to teachers at other universities, they feel this frustration. Their best students disproportionately went into finance. You know, in the older days, they would have gone into research and to public service and to medicine, into a whole variety of professions. But because of the magnitude of the lure of the money and investment banking, they disproportionately went into that area. And if a society is allocating all of its human capital in that area, there are going to be consequences. A third reason why, on average, societies with higher level of inequality don't do very well relates to the phenomenon I described before, that America is the country with the least equality of opportunity. Now, what does that mean? That means people at the bottom are not living up to their potential. Their life prospects depend on their education, depends on the education and income of their parents. And that means a large fraction of Americans are not living up to their potential, and that obviously is weakening the economy. The final thing is, a strong economy requires heavy levels of public investment. Public investment, infrastructure, technology, education. But when you have a very divided society, it's very difficult to get support for that kind of public investment. Part of the reason is that the 1%, the people at the top, worry about too strong of a government because they worry that the government might use its powers to redistribute, and they don't want that. They don't need the public parks. They don't need the public education. And so for them, government is a threat. And yet, in the long run, they're wrong, because unless you make these investments, the overall economy is not going to perform well, and they won't do well. So there's one really important idea that comes out of this analysis, and that is, if you look at the old textbooks, they always talk about trade-offs. Yes, inequality is a bad thing, they say, but to get less inequality will pay a price. The price we'll pay is lower growth, lower GDP. Okay, that's the story. So yes, there are trade-offs, and if you want more equality, you have to pay a price. What this analysis says, that we can have more equality and more growth, a more efficient economy. There's not a trade-off. In fact, this inequality is really hurting our economy. That's the reason for the title, The Price of Inequality. Well, I've described the effects on our economy. I want to say a little bit about other aspects of our society, because I do think that the level of inequality that we've achieved is weakening our democracy. And there's a fundamental puzzle here. Those of you who've studied political science know that the standard theory says that in a democracy, the outcomes should reflect the median voter, the person that half want more public spending, half want less. If you look at what's the outcome of America democracy, it doesn't reflect the median. It's much closer to reflecting the views at the top. And that's a puzzle. And I try to analyze why that is. And two hypotheses. One of them is that there's been a process of disenfranchisement. We saw that in Florida. Disempowerment and, most importantly, disillusionment. Because if you have a politics that leads to outcomes that are the same no matter what happens, that is to say, the elite drive the legislation, no matter what party, it may make some difference, but they say, well, it doesn't make a lot of difference. And you get a disillusionment with Democratic politics. And you saw that so clearly in the last election in 2010, where only 20% of the young people bothered to show up. And what they were saying is, politics isn't going to solve the problem. And that, I think, is extraordinarily bad for our democracy. The other partial reason for what's been going on has to do with advances in modern psychology, behavioral economics, marketing. Firms have learned how to sell products. For instance, they were able to sell the idea that there was no credible evidence that cigarettes cause cancer, even though the cigarette companies had in their files the evidence that it did cause cancer. But they said this over and over again. They had a good advertising campaign, and an awful lot of people believed it. The point here is, if you can sell bad, dangerous products, you can also sell bad ideas. And those in the 1% have the tools today, the modern tools, they have the resources, they have the incentives to do exactly that. And you see that over and over again. Perceptions of the degree of inequality in the United States have been shaped by those who don't want Americans to realize how unequal we are. Equality of opportunity. You know, people say, well, we don't care about equality of outcome. We care about equality of opportunity, as if that's what we have. But we don't. So there's been a concerted effort to convince America that there isn't a problem, when there clearly is. Well, what I try to do in a series of chapters in the book is to show how the growing inequality affects every aspect of our society, of our politics. So just let me give two examples. We're used to thinking of our country as determined by a rule of law, justice for all. But what do you mean by a rule of law and justice for all? A rule of law is supposed to protect those at the bottom. Just to give you one example, think about what happened in the foreclosure crisis. We threw people out of their homes under the so-called rule of law who owed nothing. And, of course, what is the bank's response? Well, their response is, well, most of the people who were thrown out of their homes did owe something. But a system of justice that says most of the people who get capital punishment were probably guilty is something that we should feel uncomfortable with. But that is the mindset of the banks. We've really undermined the rule of law. And if you look at other aspects of our system of justice, what we've evolved to is not a justice for all, but justice for those who can afford it. As another example, in Washington, you're going through the battle of the budget. You might actually think that the battle of the budget was about the deficit, but it's not. It's about this issue of inequality. If it were about the deficit, the first place you begin is to remember 10 years ago we had a surplus. We had a surplus that was so large that Alan Greenspan said that unless we do something about it, we are going to pay back our total national debt, and he would not be able to conduct monetary policy. Now, when you think about it for a moment, you realize how specious that argument was. Assume, in fact, that those surpluses had continued, and in, say, 2015, we had almost paid back the national debt. I believe that he could have gone, or his successor could have gone, to Congress and said, we face a national emergency. You have to spend more, and you have to have a deficit. I cannot believe that Congress and the administration couldn't figure out a way of spending more and getting the deficit up. And yet he made, with a straight face, that argument, and Congress passed a tax cut for the millionaires on the basis of that argument. Well, you go through the other things that happened between 2001 and today, and you realize, of course, that we converted the surplus into a very big deficit. And the obvious way to get rid of the deficit is to reverse what the four things, there are only four things that really led the change of our fiscal position between 2001 and 2011. That would go at least a very long way to correcting the deficit problem. But that kind of discussion is not on the agenda at all. What are they talking about? In a deficit reduction package that comes from Bowles Simpson, they talk about capping the tax rate at the top. So really what is here is an agenda to reduce the degree to some extent. I don't want to make it too strong, but there is at least an element here of reducing the degree of distribution, of progressivity in our economy, in our society. Well, the final chapter presents an agenda for reform, and you can see that it pretty well follows from the analysis of the sources of inequality of all the kinds, the top, the middle, and the bottom. I won't go through it because I want to open it up for question. But there is a difficult question. While it's easy to write down the economic reform agenda, I had 21 points, but my editor said you can't list 21 points in a book that anybody will buy. So it's there, but you'll have to figure it out as 21 points. We know what the economics, we know what to do. The question is, where will politics allow it? And this is where, to get the economic reforms, we're going to have political reforms. And the political agenda, I think, is fairly well understood, although there's some aspects that I try to call attention to that haven't gotten sufficient attention. But campaign finance reform, stopping the revolving doors, the role of lobbyists, and so forth. The difficulty is we're in a vicious circle. More economic inequality leads to more political inequality that leads to rules that make for more economic inequality. And the question is, how do you cut into that vicious circle? Well, I don't have any magic solution to that. I wish I did. And so that leads me to the final question, is there hope? Now, I'm of two minds about this, but I want to end on a little bit of an upbeat, because I was also told that people don't buy books if they're going to get depressed. My book, The $3 Trillion War, it became a phrase, The $3 Trillion War, but nobody wanted to buy it because it was too depressing. And it turned out to underestimate the cost of the war, and we can go into that later. So let me end on an optimistic note with a realization that there is some skepticism about this optimism. Our country has been at high levels of inequality in other times, in the Gilded Age, in the Roaring Twenties. And each of those times, we step back. We step back from the brink. In the Gilded Age, after the Gilded Age, we had the Progressive Era, where we passed antitrust laws to deal with monopoly, a whole set of legislation to make our society work better and more together. The New Deal, we know about the whole set of legislation in the 30s that made our economy work better and our society come together. So what I hope is that Americans will realize where we are, what the consequences are, what the price that we are paying for inequality, and what the price we will pay for inequality if we allow it to continue, that they'll step back from the brink and do something about what is clearly one of our most pressing problems. Thank you.
Stockholders had more control over CEO salaries until about 1980.
No, what basically happened was we didn't change our corporate governance laws, but there used to be a kind of social consensus, a kind of self-discipline that the CEO said, it is wrong for us to take a salary that's 1,000 times that of our average worker. You know, in Japan, the norm was 10. You know, in Europe, it's a, you know, maybe 30. And the United States just went out of bounds. So the, you might call it, the social contract disappeared in the United States. And then because we had no corporate governance laws like Australia had, there was nothing to restrain. And finally, the breaking of the air traffic control strike weakened unions, which had served as a partial constraint. And then we got in the situation where the company would say, we have to pay you low wages because we don't have the revenue. And the reason we don't have the revenue is because we're paying myself this, $400 million salary. And they said that again with a straight face.
Do you have any ideas? I'll bet a few people here are stockholders of some companies.
Well, there is a movement for shareholder activism, and what's really striking in Europe, it's actually working. People are voting down the exorbitant pay of a lot of CEOs. And the interesting thing is what they call exorbitant is minuscule compared to American exorbitant CEO pay.
Would you care to comment on the loss of manufacturing base in the United States, the rise of China, India, and other economies as to what the impact is on the price of inequality?
The question is not easy to fully answer, the role of globalization in this whole process. Let me say that 30 years ago, we could have kept manufacturing more in the United States. But we decided to let it go. We decided not to have any industrial policy, as it's called, no strategy. And once you let it go, you start losing your what we call dynamic comparative advantage. You become less competitive. They learn, we don't learn. They develop institutions. You take look, Germany, you mentioned Asia, but Germany maintained their industrial capacity, but they have good education oriented around it. They have a set of financial institutions. They have what they call the Mittelstand, a set of entrepreneurs that are focused on them. So they've managed to maintain it, but we've lost it and it will be very difficult to recover. But let me also say, even if we were able to do a little bit in recovering, we have to realize that manufacturing is a little bit like agriculture 100 years ago. We are the victim of our own success. Increases in productivity in agriculture meant that we went from a world in which more than 60% of people were on farmers to a world where 2% of the population grows more food than even an obese population can consume. Manufacturing has been in the same light. You know, we've been increasing productivity, and the result of that, manufacturing jobs in China are going down dramatically. So we are getting a smaller share of a declining employment, and that's why we have to restructure our economy.
Well, I didn't get to read your things. When I was an economics major, you had not written your first book yet. I have one question, but it's a little bit involved. And it's not about inequality, but you're the right person to ask the question of. If economics is a science, why are there competing economic theories with different answers to the same questions? Or do the different theories have different economic goals? And if so, why and what are they? Or have the theories of Adam Smith, F.A. Hayek, and Milton Friedman been misrepresented to us by politicians with an agenda?
Well, it's a good question. Let me... The difficulty with economics is it should be a science, but economic analysis has political consequences. And that means there are strong incentives for formulating ideas that support your political perspectives. So let me try to give examples of what I'm talking about. In my own research on asymmetries of information, all that means is the information is imperfect. Some people know more, something that other people don't know. What we showed was that the reason that Adam Smith's invisible hand was invisible was that it wasn't there. That is to say that it was not the case that the pursuit of self-interest leads inexorably to the well-being of everybody. you know, the bankers pursue their self-interest, and I don't think any of us would say it led to the well-being of all of us. So that theory has been totally discredited as a theory. But if you listen to Milton Friedman and his disciples, you would not believe that there was this research that is taught in all the graduate schools, accepted everywhere, but they have a political agenda. They want to ignore these results. Now, of course, what they try to say is, oh, yes, this is a little peccadillo, you know, imperfect information, but we're almost with perfect information. And that was why when I did my research, one of the things I showed is that even a little bit of imperfect information changed the results in a dramatic way. There was a discontinuity. Again, they don't want to pay any attention to that. So my answer is the reason why you hear different theories to a large extent, not completely, is that there is a political agenda on some of these theories. Now, there are some other cases where there's ambiguous empirical evidence. You know, the world is complicated and we have to interpret the world. And let me give you an example very briefly of where there ought to be unanimity, but there is controversy, and I'll try to explain what. And that is, there's a big debate about the role of austerity. Now, there has not been a single large economy that has ever recovered through austerity. Not a single one. Now, those on the other side have identified a few instances where governments cut back and the economy grew. Those were all small economies. And if you look at what happened, it was very simple. They were lucky. They were lucky because their trading partners were going into a boom. And so as their government spending went down, the gap was more than filled by exports. So there are some circumstances, and you could even manage it, you know, to increase your export if you're a small economy, especially if you have flexible exchange rates. But we're not a small economy, and our trading partners are really not in good shape. So there is no way that we can hope to grow through austerity. There is no way that Europe can hope to grow through austerity. There have been experiment after experiment, you might say, call it an experiment. They're real-life experiments. The first one, recent history, of course, was Herbert Hoover. And he tried austerity, converted the stock market crash into the Great Depression. I don't know why anybody wants to try that again, but there are some Republicans who want to do that. But then, if we didn't have enough evidence, the IMF did some more experiments on some involuntary patients. And it had austerity in Indonesia, Korea, Thailand, Argentina. And in each of these instances, it was a disaster. Downturns were converted into recessions, recessions into depressions. Not one of them worked. So that's an instance where people can say, oh, yes, you haven't looked at the data. There are successes. But when you look at the data more carefully, you realize there are none.
So you need to speak to Paul Ryan.
I hope he listens.
We've been hearing part two of economist Joseph Stiglitz's fine talk, How Inequality in Today's Society Endangers Our Future. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. If you missed part of the talk, you can grab the whole thing and nearly all of our 8 years of broadcasts on the web. Our address is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, 99-1 is pretty good odds, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mariah W. Stewart was a free black woman who lived in Boston, Massachusetts from the early 1820s to the early 1840s. She was the first American-born woman to lecture in public on political themes and likely the first African-American to speak out in defense of women's rights. A forerunner to Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, Mariah W. Stewart was intensely religious and was regarded as outspoken and controversial in her time. For more than a century, Mariah W. Stewart's life's contributions have remained obscured, illustrating the double pressures of racism and sexism on the lives of African American women. Mariah W. Stewart was personified by Chautauqua scholar Sandra Kamasukiri during the 1996 Democracy in America Chautauqua held in Ukiah, California. I met with Professor Kamasukiri, posing as Mariah W. Stewart, and began our visit when I asked Ms. Stewart to explain the differences between the lives of free black women in the northern states at that time and black women who were slaves in the southern states.
I often spoke of this subject in my lectures when I spoke before the people of Boston in the 1830s. In my view, there was very little difference between the free Africans in the North and those enslaved in the South. True, it is true that we are not under the lash of the slave driver, but what can be worse than the slavery of the spirit and the slavery of the mind, which is what we free Africans endure in the North?
My understanding is that although you weren't physically tortured under the lash, you were still living in segregated communities.
This is true.
And bound out as young children to work in a defined form of work. You didn't have a choice.
We did not have a choice. Many people have spoken to me and said that during my time, white children were bound out, or they used the term apprenticed. Yes, this is true. They were apprenticed into jobs and work, but these were things that would give them a good livelihood later on in their life. They were apprenticed as printers. And people of special trades. But the children of free Africans, we were always bound out or apprenticed as boot blacks, as laundresses, as seamstresses, work that we would have to continue once we were released from being bound out. And we had no choice. There were only set jobs that we were apprenticed to, if you want to use that term.
You had to continue because this was the way of making money that you learned? A person was too old to learn something else?
Young women were bound out until they were 15 or 18 years of age. Young men were bound out until they were 21 years of age. And so by then they had learned this way of work and way of living, and they continued with it. But there is something more, that of the free Africans in Boston, most of the women were domestics. They were servants, and most of the men were laborers. When we tried to seek other types of work, we were turned away. In fact, let me tell you this story. On one occasion, I went to some of the white women in the community who owned businesses, and I said to them, what if I should bring you some young African women with the best of credentials and references? Would you hire them? Would you have them work in your business? And they said to me, well, yes, we would hire them if it was up to us, but since it is not the custom, we fear that we would lose our public patronage. What a horrible thing this is, prejudice, that they would not hire these young women.
And what was done about it? What could you do? For example, was the African American Female Intelligence Society a way of addressing this?
The African American Female Intelligence Society. That's a group that I spoke to in 1832, and that was the year that they were formed. This group of strong women was dedicated to improving the life of Africans in the community and to moral uplift. And they did several things. Oftentimes, they gathered together food and clothing for the people in the community who had none. They also gathered together to help each other learn to read and write. They were also a literary society where they read books together and helped each other in the area of education. They were a very noble group. But they were not a group who were able to, let's say, create jobs for the African people.
But were they a group that was able to go to the white community and stress this issue of equal employment for African people?
They could stress this, but one thing you must understand is there was so much hatred against us at that time, is that I believed, and I often said this to my audiences, there is no people on the earth as despised as we Africans in America. And it is a thing that saddened my heart. And so, since it was difficult to get jobs, one of the things I said to my audiences is that we must create our own. I said to them, if the whites will not give you a license for a store, then you must build your own store. Put groceries on one side and dry goods on the other side. And many people said, but we cannot get an education. And I went to the women. And these were women who were members of the African American Female Intelligence Society. And I said, save your money. And in time, if you save your money, all of you, and put it together in time, you will be able to lay the cornerstone for a school. And we will be able to teach our own children. So I urged people to work together to build and to get their own money.
I'm interested in the genesis of the hatred. Why were the African people hated? Particularly in the North, where they were allowed to be free.
Free to an extent. A gentleman who spoke in your community earlier this week, a man by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville, in his book, Democracy in America, he observed, he said that nowhere is the hatred of the black greater than in those places that have never seen slavery, places such as the North. And I believe this to be true. And I try to understand, perhaps it is because they see us as people who will take the jobs from them. And so it is easy to identify us by the color of our skin. And so they have that anger. I know that in the North, there was some anger because during the Revolutionary War, not a long time before my time speaking in Boston, a mere 50 years or so, Massachusetts and other states in the North held slaves. These were slave states. And during the Revolutionary War, there were 60,000 African slaves who fled with the British and helped the British. Perhaps that is some of the anger. But I think it's a number of things that make for the hatred and the anger. But it is hatred that is unwarranted, because we people of color, we have the same love of liberty and justice as the whites.
And throughout your life, until your death in 1879, you saw this hatred ebb and flow and continue through the Civil War until almost 15 years after the Civil War.
I saw many changes. I know this. While there was hatred, in my lifetime, I always met individuals. I cannot say that I hate whites. There were many evil things that were done against me. In fact, when my husband's estate was taken from me, when I was cast out into the street, I saw the evil ways of white men spreading themselves like the green bay tree. But through my lifetime, I also saw some of that evil wither like the grass and die like the herb on the desert. So I know that these people I know that one day they will have to stand before God. I know that God will take care of the African people. And these people who have done us such injustice on that day of judgment, those people, they will call out to the rocks and the mountains to hide them.
Tell us how it was that the estate of your husband after his death was taken from you.
Oh, that was such a sad thing. I watched my husband suffer until the day that he died, and I was so grieved and my heart was broken. I'd asked God to spare his life, but on December 15th of 1829, my beloved husband died. We were married barely 3 years, and I lost him. And then 2 days later, on December 17th, 1829, a man who owned a tailor shop on the same street as my husband, a man by the name of Daniel B. Badger, he came into court with a document that he said was my husband's will. My husband owned a prosperous business in one of the most well-to-do sections of Boston, the Broad Street area. This will said that my husband's property, his entire estate, had been willed to this man, Badger. And the only thing that my husband willed to me was a bed and the bedclothes on it. And our last name was spelled incorrectly in this document. I was so shocked while the judge threw out that will. But just a few days later, the same man returned with a list of names. He said my husband had never paid his bills. And the judge gave my husband's entire estate to this man. And I was left absolutely penniless and homeless. And do you know, later on in my life, a friend of mine who was present in the court found this man Badger's false will and my husband's will. They were both on file in that court. Now, I know that it was often a common thing for those Africans with property to lose that property when one member died. And as a woman, as an African woman, I was not allowed to speak out in court. There was nothing I could do.
Were there any white people to whom you could go to speak a defense for you? Was that socially acceptable for you and the white community at that time?
It was not socially acceptable because those whites who spoke out in defense of blacks, they paid a terrible price. One of my dearest friends, lifelong friends, is the famous William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of the newspaper, The Liberator. And there were times for simply operating that newspaper that spoke out against the injustices and the horrors of slavery. There were times when his life was threatened. There were times when he was beaten in the street. So it was not a safe thing for whites to do.
Beaten in the street because he spoke out for equality for Africans,
yes,
and white people.
Yes, absolutely. His life was often threatened.
Let me ask you about Liberia and the creation of the country of Liberia on the west coast of Africa. But first, I want to say that my guest this week is Mariah W. Stewart, a free black woman who lived in Boston from the 1820s to the 1830s, and who was also the first American-born woman to lecture in public on political themes, and likely the first African-American to speak out in defense of women's rights. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Tell us about your feelings on the creation of Liberia, which I believe was created in about 1822.
Exactly. It was created by the United States in 1822, and it was created as a colony on the west coast of Africa, and its purpose was to serve as a place to which Americans could send free Africans. In the 1830s in America, there were 2 million Africans, and about 3% of those were free. Africans overall made up about 18% of the American population. And there was a feeling among slaveholders in particular that the presence of free Africans in America was a threat to slavery, is that those people enslaved could look at those who are free and wish for their own freedom. And in fact, the majority of free Africans lived in the southern states of the United States. And so a group of people began a movement which they called the American Colonization Society, and its goal was to send all free Africans back to Africa, particularly to Liberia. They engaged in many means. There were community groups of whites who raised money to buy the passage for free Africans. There were some legislatures in different states that used state money to buy the passage for free Africans. And they would send agents into our community. And this angered me so much.
Agents to do what?
Agents to persuade free Africans to go back
to return to Africa.
And in one of my speeches, I stood before my audience and said that I am an American, and before I'll be sent to a strange land, I would rather be pierced through with the bayonet. I refused to go, and I spoke out against it. Now, there were some slaveholders were in support of the colonization movement, but there were also some abolitionists who were in favor of the colonization movement. Some of them believed, with right reason, that free Africans would not be safe in America, so it was better for them to go to this new homeland, as it were, and start another life. And other abolitionists believe that slavery should be ended gradually, and as slaves are freed one by one, then those free, newly freed slaves should then be sent immediately back to Africa.
On a visit that I made to Liberia in 1984, many of the people I spoke with talked about the problems of the colonization of Liberia in that it was colonized with people who came from all parts of the African continent and were put together in a small colony in Liberia. And they brought with them different languages and different cultures and different histories, including the slaves and the free Africans. And that they felt this created a very, very difficult situation. And then, in 1984, I was told that many of the political leaders of Liberia were the descendants of the slaves, as opposed to the people who had lived there indigenously. And I'm wondering what the thought was, if there was one, of the people from North America, the African people, who were going back to Africa about being part of this mix.
I'm pleased to hear that this colony still exists in your time. I'm very saddened to hear that there have been problems with it. During my time, I think there was no thought as to what we would do once we were there. Perhaps the thought that we would be like the pilgrims, that we would work there and we would make a new land, a new home. The thought was to remove us from America.
Without forethought as to what the new home would be like.
Without forethought.
Mariah Stewart, I want to thank you for joining us here on Radio Curious, and I wish that we had a little more time. But before we go, I want to ask you the question that I ask all of my guests at this point in an interview, and that is, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
An interesting book. Is it possible for me to name two?
Please.
Okay. I would say an interesting book, and this is a book that I always shared with my audiences and it surprised them, is a book called The Fair Sketches of Women, which was published, written by a man named John Adams in 1790. And in this book, Mr. Adams talks about the rich history of women across the centuries. He talks about the women in the 1500s who were warriors and poets and divines and scholars who read and studied in Hebrew and Greek. And I often said to the members of my audiences that we must work so that such women can rise up amongst us now.
Is that John Quincy Adams?
This is a man from England by the name of John Adams.
Not the American.
Not the American.
And the other book?
And the other book. It's the greatest book of all, and I urge all people to read this book. It's a book that changed my life, and that book is the Bible.
Mariah W. Stewart, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. It has been an honor for me to be here.
And Sandra Kamusakiri, welcome to Radio Curious.
Yeah, this is great. This is a great program. I'm really pleased to have the chance to speak to you, Barry.
Well, I'm really happy that you're here. Tell us about how you fit chose or were chosen to be the character of Mariah W. Stewart.
I think it's somebody's insight or one of those great things that sort of makes a turn in your life to something mm-hmm. new. The group that put this program together is a group called the Inland Empire Education Foundation.
This is the Democracy in America Chautauqua.
Exactly, that organized, that wrote the grant for, conceptualized the Democracy in America tour. And a nice group of people, less than half a dozen, who said that people are always complaining how things are sort of going to rack and ruin in America and in communities, so let's do something about it. And through their own initiative, they put this together. Now, I was working for them as a consultant. They were developing other 19th century African-American characters. I teach African-American literature, so I was sitting and mm-hmm. helping them with the accuracy of the characters. They kept asking me to play Mariah Stewart, and I kept saying no. I've never done anything like that. I'm a teacher, and I can't even imagine it. And as I kept watching, I became more and more fascinated, and then I volunteered to audition to play Stewart. They had a national call mm-hmm. For all seven characters, so I went through their very, very rigorous audition process. And they selected me, and it's been a thrill. It's been one of the greatest things. It's a thrilling thing to do Chautauqua.
I understand that when you were doing a Chautauqua program as Mariah in Southern California, there was a person in the audience who really believed that you were a preacher and came up and asked to be blessed.
Oh, that was astounding. It's moving. Sometimes when we do these characters, there are people in the audience who are able to suspend their disbelief. But I began speaking as Stewart, and one section I talk about Stewart's conversion and her belief in God, her dedication of her life to speaking for God. And in the midst of that part, a man got up out of his seat, walked forward, stood in front of me, and bowed his head and put my hand on his head. Now, people around, this is America, we're getting nervous and we're getting about ready to pounce on him. But then someone said, he wants you to bless him. And there was a minister in the second row who called out the blessing. I repeated the blessing with my hand on this gentleman's head. And then he looked up at me, he shook my hand, and he walked away. It was the most moving thing for me.
Tell us how you felt, the movement, the call on you to bless him.
When I looked at him, when he put my hand on his head, you know, there's that moment. He wasn't a kook. He wasn't drunk. He wasn't drugged, as some people thought. And I looked in his eyes, and he was a human being and had such nice eyes, and he believed. But on another level, so I was saying, okay, believe in God as the character. I believe in God. I dedicated my life to God. But then on another level, that's not acting. That's also truth. And mm-hmm. it was truth for him. And so in that moment, there was no performance. There was no character playing. And I was really honored to do that for him. I mean, he also gave me a gift also, that I could have that effect, that positive effect on people.
I can see that in your eyes as we sit here and talk.
Yeah, it was quite a moment.
Yeah. I want to ask you, as the scholar, the genesis of the hatred in America that you spoke of as Mariah, and that I fear that you probably have experienced in your own life mm-hmm. towards African people.
Sure.
Now up into the 1990s.
Yeah. You know, America's racial history is so complicated, and it's so tangled. And sometimes I don't know where to start. When I teach African-American literature, and we're in the 19th century, and talking about literature near and around the Civil War, sometimes I talk about it on a psychological level, is that when you wrong another person, just in your daily life, when you wrong another person and you do it knowing that you're wronging them and you hurt them grievously, then one of the things you fear is what? You fear that somehow they're going to get back at you. And so during this time, you've got 2 million blacks, by the time of the Civil War, 14 million blacks, most of whom have been enslaved. And people knew, they knew in their hearts that this was not right what they were doing. And so one fear is the human reaction. These people are going to get back at us. So I think there's a psychological fear. I also think there's the fear of guilt. Also, when you hurt someone, you feel guilty afterwards. And most people, that's not a good a thing to feel. They find ways to avoid it. And one way is to shut out that thing that you've hurt. Another is, I think in the 90s, we're living with this legacy because the decision to end slavery, contrary to popular belief, was not a moral decision made by the American people. If it had been a moral decision, people rising up as a group and saying, this is wrong, this is immoral, we don't want to do it anymore, I don't think we would have the legacy of hatred. It was not a moral decision. It was a war maneuver by President Lincoln to end slavery. So I think we have the legacy because it was not something that was decided in the psyche, the hearts, the minds of Americans. It was one president's, with his advisors, legal maneuver. This will disrupt the South if we free all these people. The South was using blacks as labor to help in their war effort. So I think it's a lot of factors. I think it's economic. I mean, I could really get into capitalism, which depends on a large labor base with a small pool at the top of haves. Yeah. So I think it's lots of factors. I think it's something, though, we're going to have to sort out because my last point on this, because of this, is that when you say, let's just take blacks, when you say that blacks are not human, then that means that the person who says that, that when you say that, you have lost the ability to recognize the humanity in another person. Now, when you have lost that ability, it shows up in other areas. So we as a nation, we can say that America has an anti-black climate right now, but that inability to recognize the humanity in another person carries over into other areas. So we have problems with gender issues. We have problems recognizing the humanity in our children and recognizing how they need to be protected. We have problems respecting our elderly and seeing them as human. We have problems respecting those who are disabled and handicapped. So it carries over into other areas. And these are things we're going to have to rectify if we're going to be a healthy nation.
Sandra, I'd love to talk more, but we're running out of time, and I want to ask you the same question I always ask at the end of an interview. Could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, an interesting book that I've read lately. I would recommend that that someone read Mariah Stewart's speeches and her book. It's in a book, The First Black Political Writer in America, edited by Marilyn Richardson, and she has an incredibly wonderful, lengthy introduction that sets the historical background and context of life of free blacks in Boston in the 1830s. So I would recommend that one. Learn more about Mariah W. Stewart.
Sandra Kamusakiri, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Yeah, thank you, Barry Vogel. It's an honor to be here.
Mariah W. Stewart was personified in this program by Professor Sandra Kamusakiri, an Associate Vice President Emeritus of the Emeritus English Faculty of the California State University at San Bernardino, California. The book that Mariah W. Stewart recommends is the Bible. The book that Sandra Kamusakiri recommends is Mariah W. Stewart, America's First Black Woman Political Writer, edited by Marilyn Richardson. This program was originally broadcast in 1996. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
Protesters arrested declare New York City an ICE-free zone and push back against Obama's New Year's resolution to deport Central Americans.
What do you do when they say get back? We fight back. In response to the ongoing raids of non-citizens and the recent announcement of raids against Central American refugees, immigrant right advocates, labor unions, and faith-based groups and community members gathered to say no to raids, demand an end to deportations, and announce the creation of ICE-free zones throughout New York City. First, Obama, already known in immigrant communities as the deporter-in-chief, announced the Deportation Priority Program called Priority Enforcement Program, known as PEP. Shortly after the announcement of PEP, home raids in New York City increased at an alarming rate. Then Obama's Department of Homeland Security announced impending nationwide raids aimed at deporting the primarily women and children, many of whom are refugees who fled some of the most violent regions in the world, in particular Central America.
But the ICE-Free New York City campaign demands that the Department of Corrections and New York City Police Department must end all collaboration with ICE, prohibit the sharing of information about New Yorkers between ICE and the city agencies that may reveal an individual's immigration status. The ICE-Free New York City campaign stands in solidarity and put their bodies on the line to protect immigrant refugee families and create ICE-free zones within the five boroughs in Long Island.
We head to ICE-Free New York City's protest, covered by Building Bridges reporter Ken Nash.
ICE-Free NYC!
They say get back!
We say fight back!
Get back!
Fight back!
No more raids! And no more deportations of our people. My name is Chris. I'm here from Families for Freedom with the rest of the people from the ICE Free NYC campaign. We want New York City to be ICE free. We do not want ICE in our communities. Do not want ICE in our schools. No more deportations. No more raids. No ICE in New York City. Woo! These raids have not only impacted communities of Latino descent, they are attacking of all people, of all different backgrounds. We have Jeffrey Lagonde, who is a victim, but a survivor of these raids, and whose partner and husband is still behind in detention.
On September 1st, three officers called my husband and told him that they needed to speak with him. And I was home getting ready to go to work. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and he is the full-time caregiver of our children. He proceeded to go downstairs with my 1-year-old to go speak to these officers. And about 5 minutes later, he came back upstairs. Three gentlemen came into my apartment and said that they just needed to take him downtown here in Manhattan to fill out paperwork, because they are immigration officers, and he would be home in the afternoon. He has been in detention since September 1st for a charge that was back in 1997. 17 years later, you come to pick up someone whose life is not the same, who is not the same person, who has grown from whatever incident he may have had in the past, to tear him away from his family. He has 8 American children here that needs his guidance, his support, and his fatherhood. Trying to send him back to a country that he has not known since he was 8 years old. To send him back to a country that they have no knowledge of. They don't know how to work. They don't know how to get food in this country. But not only if they send him back to this country, what do I do with my children without their father here? What do I do with my life, my partner that I have been with for 7 years? My family is immigrants. We came here. We work. We pay taxes. We are law-abiding citizens. You cannot come and tear someone away from their family just because of something that they learned from 10 to 15 years ago. This is what's happening. None of us were here originally. We all came from somewhere. So to continue to try to deport and tear people away from the country they know, the country they're trying to help, and the country that they just want to live and be free with their families is disgraceful of our history.
Yeah. Here today we have Cruz Control, who is an activist for the El Salvadoreño community and also directly impacted.
I am a Salvadoran immigrant, and I know directly the effects of U.S. policy on El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. All these countries had deportees from California and other places, gang members who made El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras worse than it already was. We have policies instituted by the United States that have made a living situation a living hell. That's the only reason why we're here, because our countries were made worse by the policies instituted by this country. The White House says they weren't going to deport families, but now they refuse to let us know how many children they have arrested in these new raids. Mothers, children, whose only crime was trying to escape the most dangerous countries in Central America. Help us stop these raids.
Next, I would like to introduce everybody to Donna Schaefer from the New Sanctuary Movement.
Hi. Deportation was always immoral, ungodly, un-American, and stupid. So ramping up deportation is doubly immoral, ungodly, un-American, and stupid. We represent many, many hundreds of congregations in New York City, and we're fed up. By Monday, we will have an announcement of how many congregations and synagogues and mosques in this city are going to open their doors. This will be called physical sanctuary. We are fed up, and we believe that deportation is not going to be done in our name.
Next, we have another person who has been directly impacted by these unjust raids into her home. Her name is Carol McDonald.
I've been impacted by the deportation because they deport my husband and many, many, many more other family that have children. They come to your home and take your family and you leave as a single mother, as a single parent. Right now that the children, they are impacted by the deportation. There are many, many family that live here homeless, have to fight now for a family. They can't come back to the country and we leave as single mothers to fight for the children. I have an 18-year-old daughter, can't see her father for 10 years now. She can't see her father. And there's many, many more heartaches like this. Put yourself in our place that your children can't see the father and you leave as a single mother. I'm a single mother today coming out here to speak because today's my day off. This been impacting me for 12 years, but I still support the group. I'm not going to leave the group to see better come because it's struggle on us to be a single parent now. Thank you very much.
Next, we have Antonio, who's a member of the immigrant community here in New York City.
Buenas tardes, compañeros.
Mi nombre es Antonio y soy del Grupo Internacionalista. Yo creo que es el momento de decir basta. Basta a estas redadas de inmigración. Compañeros, cuando Jen Johnson y Barack Obama nos dicen...
Good afternoon. My name is Antonio. I'm here to tell you that when the government says that they're going after criminals, it's not true. They're going after women and children. Today, it is our brothers and sisters from Central America. Tomorrow, it could be any one of us. Republicans call us criminals, and the Democrats deport us by the millions. In 2009, who was it that designed the coup d'etat in Honduras? It was Hillary Clinton. So we're seeing now that created a situation where Honduran refugees are fleeing to the United States, fleeing from a violence created by us. And now they're saying we will not accept Syrian refugees. I am here to say immigrants deserve full rights. How do we stop these raids? We need to galvanize our workers. We work here. We build your houses. We cook your meals. Remember that. So Republicans and Democrats are not responding to our needs. We need to create political power so that we can raise our own voices. Next, we have Lupe Ambrosio, who's here representing immigrant youth.
Undocumented and afraid. Undocumented and unafraid. Undocumented and unafraid. Undocumented and
unafraid.
There we go. All right. I just want to start off by saying that we started off the New Year's at the YLC working on a deportation case. People were picked up in New Year's Eve, okay? So when we brought the New Year, we said, no, we got to start organizing and working, right? But it should not take that for us to get outraged. It should not take our families to be taken away from us to be upset. We already knew this was happening to people that had criminal records. People that have criminal records are also our families. They should not be put into who deserves to be deported, who does not deserve to be deported. We all deserve to be here with our families, okay? I work with undocumented youth. Many of them just newly arrived. I went to visit some high schools already, and the first thing that I heard is, what is happening? Are we in danger? That should not be a conversation to have in school, to be scared to go to school, to leave your family. So when we say that we are here for undocumented youth, we give DACA and such, and then we deport kids as young as 4 years old back to what they are running away from violence. Let's be clear on that, okay? Not one more. It's not just Latinos, Mexicans, Central Americans that are being affected by deportations, okay? We have a lot of different immigrant communities in New York State that deserve to also be represented. And we should not just focus on our Central American people are getting deported. Let's be afraid. We should be afraid because it's kind of scary. But let's not just take this opportunity to be upset. When Black people were getting deported, we didn't say much, right? This is the time for all of us to stay in unity and fight back. When our communities are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back. When our communities are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back.
Next, we have Tina representing the Filipino community.
The people united!
We'll never be defeated!
Ang tao! Ang bayan! My name is Nina Macapinlock, and I am representing Bayan USA. We are here to condemn the ICE raids as a form of state terror against our people. Our people who have suffered so much already under U.S. imperialism. We are here because we believe that this is a declaration of war by the Department of Homeland Security against poor and working class migrant communities. If this is a fear tactic, raiding families at 5 to 8 in the morning, raiding them as a way to respond to the Central American refugee crisis, we condemn this act of war, and we are here to say, not one more, we will not stand stand for it anymore. 1 in 6 Filipinos are undocumented in this country, making up one of the largest undocumented Asian populations in the United States. Fight for liberation! When immigrant rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When immigrant rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When immigrant rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
We fight back! If they want to take our people and put them in cages, we need to take them and hold them accountable. Because these are human rights violations. This is an impact on our human dignity. If we continue to let them take our families, take our children, take our people, what do we have? This is why we have to continue to fight. This is just the beginning. We have been fighting for our liberation, and we will continue to fight for our liberation. This is just the beginning of our fight against ICE, against the police, against all of this criminal system that continues to cage our people. We gotta do something. This building right here, the reason why we're holding it here is because they deport people from here. They take the people and bring them here to Barrack Street. After they take them to Barrack Street, they ship them to New Jersey or Batavia in New York, where we don't see them. But we see them. We've been seeing them for the past how many months in detention. We have been fighting, and we will just continue to fight, because this is the only way we got. This is the only thing that we have to uphold our human dignity. We need to do something. When our communities are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
When refugees are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
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 And let's make this clear. We see what's going on in our home country, from the Philippines to El Salvador to Mexico. U.S. imperialism has impacted our community so much that it's also impacting us here. And we need to expose it even further. We need to take the stand, and we need to fight. When our homes are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
When our families are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
Y no nos vamos, y si nos echan, no regresamos.
Aquí estamos,
y no nos vamos, y si nos echan, no regresamos.
So thank you so much for being here. We want ICE to know that we're not going to take them coming into our homes anymore.
The demonstrators have moved on to Barrack Street, and seven have sat down in the middle of the street blocking traffic. Excuse me, why are you blocking traffic?
Because the ICE raids are frankly unconstitutional and more illegal than any undocumented immigrant that would ever make their way into the States. We can't break up families. You can't send people back to places they're trying to flee, especially when a lot of the problems in those countries are caused by this country right here.
Thank you. Excuse me, why are you blocking traffic on this issue of immigration right now on Barrack Street?
Immigration, ICE, or La Migra, as we like to call them, has been threatening our communities, and this is our way of responding, saying we're not playing around. You don't play around with our communities. We're going to fight back, and this is a way. This is just the beginning, so they need to understand that we're willing to put our bodies on the line for our people.
What do you believe Obama is doing this at this point?
Obama is still the deporter-in-chief. I think anything he does, I mean, I think he's a hypocrite. Obama has been constantly talking about families and deportations. This government starts creating refugees in other countries, and then when they come here, then we kick them out and deport them. I don't think that's correct, and I don't have any respect for someone like that.
La migra, la misma porquería, la policía, la migra.
Why are you blocking traffic?
Because we want to stop the mass deportation of immigrants like me that is being caused by the Democratic Party. Obama continues mass deporting people like me, students, children, family members. He continues to separate them, and we're tired of being persecuted. I'm Mexican, but my whole family is undocumented, including myself.
And what's happening with your family?
My family right now, contributing to this economy. We have a business. We have friends here. We go to church. We're doing everything possible to survive, yet we're being persecuted just because we weren't born here. We contribute. We pay taxes. And there's a lot of people like us who will continue getting persecuted, and we're tired. We're scared that another Democratic Party will continue. Hillary Clinton already stated that she wanted to continue mass supporting refugee kids. So we're scared that this is going to continue, and we're tired of this injustice to happen, and we hope to see change in legislation. We hope that there is a huge immigration reform, the DREAM Act, because DAPA and DACA are not enough.
Thank you so much. The cops are sort of standing around, and they didn't expect this, so I guess we're going to wait to get reinforcements before they try to clear the streets. Excuse me, when you say ICE-free NYC...
So when we say ICE-free NYC, we mean we need a sanctuary for people to go, for people to feel safe, for people to be able to go from their home to work without the fear of deportation. Children, women, everyone. So ICE-free NYC means no more harassment, no more 4 a.m., kick your door open, raid your home, grab your, snatch your children, your woman, everyone. That's what we mean by ICE-free NYC.
Does it mean the New York City government shouldn't be cooperating with ICE?
Definitely, definitely. New York City's helping them collect all this information. They can put all these humans through the process of deportation. New York City should stop collaborating with ICE, because ICE is destroying lives and destroying families.
We got the paddy wagon here. Cops are getting ready to move in.
Stand up, fight back!
Stand up, fight back!
Shut it down!
And if we don't get it,
shut it down!
NYC!
Excuse me. What do you specifically mean by ICE-free NYC?
We're speaking about immigration's relationship to the carceral system, specifically at Rikers Island, where there is immigration officers. Oftentimes, when people, non-citizens, or people without certain documentation status get detained by police, they are immediately expedited through immigration system as well. So we want to cut those ties between immigration and police, and to tell them to stop this terror on our families.
Thank you.
Deportation's got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho.
The demonstrators bound together by about 3-foot tubes, which their arms are in, and it attaches each demonstrator to the other. They're made up of plastic and wire and duct tape, and the cops don't know how to separate the demonstrators so they can arrest them. Demonstrators are sitting down the street before, now they're lying down the street.
Hostage! Hostage!
La migra! La policía! La misma porquería!
You have refused to leave this roadway. I am now ordering your arrest on the charge of disorderly conduct. If you interfere with your army made against you for obstructing governmental administration, you are further advised that the charge of obstructing the crime under the laws of New York. You will be fingerprinted and subject to formal...
How do you spell racist? How do you spell racist?
working on the tubes with wire cutters.
We say fight back! We say fight back! Fight back! Fight back! Fight back!
Shame! 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 Shame!
Pa' arriba! Pa' abajo! La migra pa'l carajo! Pa' arriba! Pa' abajo! La migra pa'l carajo!
We are together!
We are united!
We are together!
We are united!
Leading some protesters into the paddy wagons.
We are together!
We are with you!
We are with you!
We are with you!
Ice cream! Ice cream!
Ice cream!
Ice cream!
Ice cream!
Ice cream!
Ice cream!
Freedom ain't free. You were listening to the Ice Free New York City campaign, and there were 7 arrests. We want to thank Building Bridges reporter Ken Nash for that outstanding report, and we too will continue to stand with our sister and brother immigrant refugees and declare New York City and Long Island an ICE-free zone. Let's make it so.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Is the Lord's house. Amen. And before you can ever own this property, men who are fags will be carrying babies.
Two closeted Muslim teenagers find themselves caught in FBI surveillance as they struggle with questions about who they are and who they want to be.
Clearly in the Quran, Sodom and Gomorrah, that was about rape. That wasn't about being gay.
Gays are fajir.
Well then, we have something else to tell you.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. India's Supreme Court agrees to hear a curative sodomy law challenge, a homophobic Harlem church faces Queer Judgment Day, and the closet and national security collide in Naz and Malik. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 6, 2016. India's Supreme Court has agreed to hear what's called a curative petition to reconsider its December 2013 ruling that recriminalized all lovemaking that does not involve vaginal sex with the intent of reproduction. Convictions can bring up to 10 years in prison. That decision shocked most activists and made millions of LGBT people outlaws again in the world's second most populous country. It restored India's Penal Code Section 377, the colonial-era sodomy law, which had been ruled unconstitutional by the Lower Delhi High Court in 2009. Its resurrection also offered implicit permission for increased police harassment and arrests, extortion, and a spike in reports of homophobic and transphobic hate violence. A curative petition asks the High Court to cure its earlier decision as a miscarriage of justice. Equality advocates express cautious optimism after the justices announced this week that there are important constitutional questions involved in the issue relating to decriminalizing consensual gay sex within the privacy of a house. The court announced that a 5-judge panel led by the Chief Justice would decide the matter, although no date was set for the next hearing. An eventual ruling could be the final word on the issue from India's highest court.
That December 2013 High Court ruling said it was up to the country's parliament to overturn the statute, not the courts. But the lower house of India's parliament refused to even consider a private member's bill to overturn Section 377 just 2 months ago. Its sponsor, Congressman Shashi Tharoor, is leading an online petition drive to pressure the government into sponsoring a repeal measure.
To the delight of many LGBT activists, India's Roman Catholic Cardinal, Oswald Gracias, the Archbishop of Bombay and president of the country's Conference of Catholic Bishops, called this week for the repeal of Section 377. I believe maybe people have this orientation that God has given them, and for this reason they should not be ostracized from society, he said.
Opponents of civil marriage equality in both Taiwan and Bermuda are pushing the idea of voter referendums to ban it. A February 4th hearing by Taiwan's Central Election Commission was called after Christian fundamentalists associated with the Faith and Hope League submitted more than 130,000 petition signatures to require a public vote on every proposal to redefine civil marriage in the civil code as anything but exclusively heterosexual. According to the English-language Taipei Times, achieving the first 100,000 signature threshold potentially moves the proposal into a second petition drive phase if its wording is approved. LGBT activists have been trying to move a civil marriage equality bill through Parliament for the past few years. To describe the effort as an uphill battle, however, would be an understatement. Nevertheless, hopeful opponents of the referendum worry that it would unconstitutionally limit the legislature's power to pass such laws. The government's executive branch seems to agree. Lynn Salian of the Ministry of Justice told the hearing that the proposal fails to clearly establish or overturn national policy as required by law, and that the broad referendum language is inconsistent with legal requirements and could also impact several different areas of the law because of its scope.
Meanwhile, the group Preserve Marriage Bermuda is pressuring their government to sponsor relevant changes in legislation to ensure that civil marriage in the island nation is defined only as a union between a man and a woman. The British Overseas Territories Royal Gazette newspaper reports that the group is warning that even civil unions are slippery slopes to marriage equality. Referencing court rulings for civil marriage equality in other countries, the conservative Christian group is also calling for a voter referendum on the matter. If government is unwilling to stand strong for the Society of Bermuda, said spokesman Pastor Gary Simons at a media conference this week, then the voting population of Bermuda and their elective representatives must be free to deliberate and vote about marriage policy through a referendum and not by unelected judges. But Tawana Tannock, president of Bermuda's Human Rights Commission, told the Gazette that, as stated numerous times previously, we remain committed to equality and respect for all. Additionally, she added, we specifically reject the notion that the opinion of the majority should impinge on the right of equal treatment for minorities.
Five more countries in the Muslim Middle East have banned the critically acclaimed trans drama The Danish Girl because of culturally unacceptable content, or for promoting homosexuality and gender transformation, or simply for moral depravity. It stars Oscar winner Eddie Redmayne as real-life trans pioneer Lili Elba. The Danish Girl and its stars have been nominated in several best categories at the upcoming Oscars and in other movie awards around the globe. Qatar was the first country to ban The Danish Girl. It's now been rejected by government censors in the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Bahrain, Jordan, and Kuwait.
Elsewhere, the governor of the U.S. state of Maine, Paul LePage, this week took the teeth out of an effort to protect transgender school students. Maine's Department of Education and Human Rights Commission wanted to issue legally binding rules to guarantee transgender students equal access to campus facilities. The rules would have instituted a 2014 state Supreme Court decision in the case of Nicole Maines, a transgender student who was denied access to the girls' bathroom at her elementary school, even though she'd been using it without incident for quite a while. The ruling also ordered school officials to pay the young trans girl a penalty of $75,000 for violating her rights. A spokesman for LePage, Adrian Bennett, told the Associated Press that the governor believes the state high court ruling requires action by the legislative, not the executive branch. Schools will now be encouraged only to follow guidelines for properly addressing the needs of transgender students. There are no penalties for failing to do so.
In other news, the United Nations Postal Administration has released six new postage stamps promoting equality for LGBT people. Not many people know that the global body has its own postal service. The colorful and fanciful French Art Deco-style commemorative stamps, created by out-Cuban-American artist Sergio Baradat, also celebrate the LGBT community's diversity. One specifically features a person with butterfly wings, becoming who they really are, blossoming, Baradat said. Their release marks the first time the UN Post Office has issued stamps with an LGBT theme. They were unveiled in a ceremony on February 4th at the UN General Assembly building that included a performance by the New York Gay Men's Chorus. The newly released series of stamps support the UN Human Rights Office's Free and Equal campaign, which promotes better treatment of LGBT people. The set includes two stamps in English, two in French, and two in German. They're available for purchase at UN headquarters in New York, Geneva, and Vienna, and online at unstamps.org.
The founder and CEO of the popular gay escort website, rentboy.com, has been indicted in New York City on charges of money laundering and promoting prostitution. As we previously reported, Jeffrey Herant was among seven people arrested when the Department of Homeland Security raided the website's global headquarters in Manhattan last August. According to the New York Daily News, prosecutors gave each of the other defendants plea agreements, though no further details were reported. The criminal complaint against Herant alleges that rentboy.com was essentially an internet brothel. The indictment also seeks the forfeiture of about $1.5 million seized in the raid and permanent seizure of the Rent Boy website, which is now under federal control. It had averaged 500,000 unique visitors daily, and according to prosecutors, generated more than $10 million in revenue from 2010 to 2015. Horant's lawyer, Michael Tremont, told Reuters that he ran his business openly for nearly 20 years, and it makes no sense to single him out for criminal prosecution. Popular gay sex advice columnist Dan Savage was among several LGBT luminaries to defend the website, famously asking on his blog when it had become the Department of Homeland Security's job to protect gay and bi men from buying and selling blowjobs.
And finally, the annual Screen Actors Guild Awards on January 30th seemed to be a stern rebuke to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences voters, who've been widely criticized for failing to nominate a single person of color in any of the major Oscars acting awards for the last 2 years. The multi-talented Queen Latifah joined a parade of SAG Award winners that included Idris Elba, Uzza Aduba, and Viola Davis. Latifah took home the trophy for female actor in a television movie or miniseries for portraying bisexual blues singer Bessie Smith in the HBO movie Bessie, which she also co-executive produced. Latifah herself has been rumored to have slept with women, and during a 2012 performance at a Pride Festival in Long Beach, California, she called LGBT people her peeps. But the queen has refused to answer specific questions about her sexuality. And she ended her SAG Awards acceptance speech by encouraging everyone watching to not let others define them and what they can achieve.
I hope that anyone out there who does not come in the package that people say you should, keep fighting for it. Flip those rocks over. Keep pushing. Keep turning. You can do it. You build your own boxes, not people. So knock that thing away and do you. Thank you.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 6th, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
Gender identity and a forbidden romance each come under the lens later in the program. But first... It looks like God will have the last laugh on a controversial anti-LGBT church in Harlem, New York. ATLA, Worldwide Missionary Church, has become infamous for its marquees questioning President Obama's sexual orientation and its internet broadcasts proclaiming that Starbucks lattes are laced with sodomite semen. But now the church is sinking into the fiery pit of bankruptcy, and LGBT activists are raising money to buy the building at public auction. The Ali Forney Center and the inclusive Rivers of Living Waters Church want to turn Harlem's homophobic hotbed into a queer youth shelter and parish building. ATLA's pastor James David Manning responded with his inimitable theological acumen.
Oh, come along with me to my little corner of the world.
I see this, as many of the elders have discussed, as just more of an opportunity for us to get more press and to get more coverage to explain our position and as to who we are. Right now, the articles are jumping all over the place. I've gotten calls from everybody about this, the news organization. In fact, I share this with you to all the sodomites that think that you're going to purchase this church and a foreclosure sale. Let me tell you something. Before you can ever own the Lord's house, because that's what this is.
That's right.
That this is the Lord's house. This ain't no damn bathhouse.
That's right.
This ain't no fag house. This is the Lord's house.
Amen.
And before you can ever own this property, hook or crook to own this property, you will be carried, men who are fags with testicles will be carrying babies in their testicles and given birth to them through their anus. That's how impossible it is for you to
That's
get
right.
this house.
That's right.
When you start carrying a baby in your bags and birthing that baby through your ass, then
right.
you can own this house.
Tell
Until
pastor.
I see you pull a baby out yes. your ass, you ain't going to pull this church out from underneath to us. And boom shakalaka yes. goes right there.
Yes,
and
yes.
all you fags can go to hell
That's
and
right.
do it now. I'm James David Manning, everybody. I'm the Lord's servant.
That's all, folks.
But wait, there's more. ATLA Worldwide Missionary Church pastor James David Manning probably doesn't see the irony in the fact that the Ali Forney Center and the Rivers of Living Waters Church have nearly reached their $200,000 goal to purchase his building. You can track their progress at aliforneycenter.donordrive.com. That's A-L-I-F-O-R-N-E-Y center.donordrive.com. Religious bigotry comes up again after we turn another page.
There's so many kinds of books with different styles and different looks.
Which are best, we just can't say.
We can't say,
but whichever one you pick.
How about books with pictures? Commentator Janet Mason gives us three to choose from.
Recently, I came across three excellent photography books from Daylight Books that address various forms of gender expression. In Every Breath We Drew, queer photographer Jess T. Dugan doesn't put her subjects in a category. Rather, the subjects are united, in her words, by my attraction to them. And not a romantic attraction particularly, but a more complicated attraction of recognizing something in them I also perceive or desire in myself. The result is an intriguing collection of stellar color photographs, inclusive of soft butch lesbians, straight men, trans men, and gay men. In Devotions, a naked woman kneels on the bed, tying the boot of a person who is off camera. The peak of her short hair comes to the front of her head, and she leans over the boot and ties the lace as if she is praying. In my mind, the boot is on the foot of her lesbian lover. But the beauty of the photograph, one of them, is that it can be interpreted by the viewer. Gays in the Military, Photographs and Interviews by Vincent Chiani, also published by Daylight Books, is a starker collection of black and white photographs suitable to life lived in the shadows until the relatively recent repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The first photo shows a person in camouflage uniform, I assume he's male given the shaved head and the hat, looking away from the camera toward the tree and horizon line of the hill behind him. It's a good photograph and an apt metaphor, given that gays and lesbians in the military had to live clandestine lives. In the rest of the photos in this collection, the people show their faces. Still, there's a haunted quality to many, if not most, of the photographs. Decades ago, I knew a few lesbians who had been in the military, and none talked about violence or war or killing as a reason they enlisted. This sentiment was echoed in the book. Franz Cuba, also from Daylight Books, is a beautiful book of color photographs by Mariette Pathy Allen. In reading the introduction by the photographer, I gained a new insight into the life of sexual minorities in Cuba. I see transgender Cubans as a metaphor for Cuba itself, people living between genders in a country moving between doctrines. As restrictions decrease, discrimination against people who are gender nonconformists is becoming less prevalent. A lot of credit for making their lives easier belongs to Raul Castro's daughter, Mariela. There are many beautiful images in the book. One in particular seemed to say it all. A trans woman is sitting on her bed holding her one-week-old piglet, feeding the newborn with a bottle. The composition is perfect. Charito's brown shorts matched the headboard of the bed and the side table. The wall behind is the pale aqua that is so prevalent in Cuba, and a single chiffon scarf hanging from the wall has pink flowers on it that match the pink of the newborn pig. And the pig is loving Charito, not judging her. The trans women represented in this book are bravely living their lives and creating a more open world without rigid gender roles that we all can live in, including heterosexuals. That's why it's called liberation. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Against a background of anti-Muslim suspicion, our Steve Pride introduces us to a new movie that examines a closet full of contradictions.
Excuse me? Can I talk to you for a minute? I'm with the FBI. What's your name?
Malik Allen Muhammad.
Did you try to buy a gun today?
No. Well, someone offered me one and I said no.
What have you been doing then?
I went to school and I was selling stuff on the street with my friend Nas.
Is that all?
We went to our mosque. We hung out.
And what were you doing yesterday?
I was at school. And then I went to Nas' house.
What's Nas's last name?
Hassan.
What'd you do after that?
I stayed for a while. Till late.
I'm Margaret Catcher. I'm the producer of Nas and Malik.
And I'm Jay Dockendorf. I'm the writer and director of Nas and Malik.
And what's the film about?
Two closeted Muslim teenagers who, over the course of a single day, find themselves caught in FBI surveillance as they struggle with questions about who they are and who they want to be.
And what inspired this film?
A number of things, but primarily it came from the experience of living in Bed-Stuy, where the movie takes place, with a man who was in his late 20s who was still closeted to his family and also Muslim. I spent a lot of time talking with him and getting to know him and ultimately interviewed him. That interview became the basis of the screenplay. At the same time, in New York, there was an enormous amount of FBI and NYPD surveillance happening of the Muslim communities there. And several articles in the Associated Press caught my attention on that subject. Those articles ultimately won the Pulitzer Prize that year. They sort of influenced the screenplay as well. And then on top of that, it's about the relationship between two men. So I based it on some of my closest relationships and the debates and fights and high points and low points that I've experienced in my own life.
How accepting is this particular community?
I don't necessarily think that the larger Muslim community has grappled necessarily with the issue of closetedness and the issue of gayness in America. It's clear that among the most devout members of the community, gayness is verboten. And yet there are trailblazers. There's an imam in Washington, D.C. who runs an LGBT-friendly mosque. There are a number of brave men and women who have appeared in documentaries about the conflict between homosexuality and Islam's beliefs. There's a great documentary called Gay Muslims, believe it or not, through the BBC that I saw that was moving and inspiring and a big part of researching this film for me and getting to know the interior lives of characters like Nas and Malik.
What about casting? Times have changed, but even 10 years ago, it was hard to cast young actors in gay roles.
It was a wonderful challenge to find two people who could inhabit the personalities of these characters and who wanted to grapple with these conversations they had to have and were comfortable walking and talking as much and rehearsing a non-traditional movie. I saw about 100 young men for these two roles, 100 really talented actors who were all hungry to be in this movie, and it was an honor that so many people came out to the casting call. And then ultimately settled on Curtis Cook Jr. and Kerwin Johnson Jr., who I thought were fantastic. We rehearsed the movie pretty extensively on location, walking through the script, one location to the next, and that experience forged an intimacy between Curtis, Kerwin, and myself that I think created the chemistry.
There's a lot of movement in your film.
I just remembered really specifically from being a teenager that I loved to move and be active. It was like a rehearsal for sexuality in a certain way, especially with someone that you're attracted to. If you can't necessarily connect with them completely on a sexual basis, just like being in their presence and like doing some activity that sublimated that energy into something else made a lot of sense and I think was perfectly natural. I also think that teenagers who can't drive, especially in New York, who want to spend the day alone out of their house where they can really be themselves, are going to want to stay on the move. I thought that their movement kind of spoke to the intensity of the surveillance that happens just within their own families. To get away with that, they had to sort of stay on the move, as it were.
What do you want the audience to take away from the film?
The originality of the story and touching on a subject that hasn't really been touched on before. I'd like the film to leave the audience with a feeling of exploring something that they hadn't explored before with a film. And something I think everyone can relate to is this idea that when you're young, you feel that your secrets and your problems will have consequences that are far greater than they actually are. And two young kids dealing with the secrecy surrounding their own identity is really damaging to their own trajectory into adulthood. I think that what I'd like people to take away is some sort of reflection of themselves in that experience and also a sympathy with these characters who I feel we've portrayed heroically as they're going through that struggle that a lot of kids and a lot of people, regardless of age, are going through as well.
And I think that it would be great if audiences watched Nazim Malik, met Nazim Malik.
Do you think it's wrong to be gay?
Yeah, man. Islam is a poem. It's not complicated like that.
Yeah, but a lot of things are a lot more haram. Clearly in the Quran. Sodom and Gomorrah. That was about rape. That wasn't about being gay.
Okay, so your point? Gays are fajir.
Well then, we have something else to tell you.
If you know someone who's gay, it's much easier to sympathize. And if you love someone who's gay as a friend, you want to accept them because they love you. And this reciprocity kind of equalizes biases in conflicts that happens as friendship develops. It does seem that a lot of the Muslim community in Bed-Stuy in particular isn't particularly welcoming to the homosexual community. We asked a couple of times if we could meet imams to talk about this. And a few people just sort of said, that's not a conversation that we want to have. And moved on.
This has been a conversation about the film Nazim and Malik with its director Jade Dockendorf and producer Margaret Catcher. Find more information about the film online at wolfvideo.com. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Means to will in God's name without a ball and a chain, a slave falling in plain. Bismillah, we're forever holding the peace with the streets, crippled little queens.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Sarah Sweeney, Michael LeBeau, Janet Mason, Sir Ian McKellen, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KAZU Pacific Grove, California, WCRS Columbus, Ohio, 2MTM Coonamble, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, part two of our interview with Manfred Steger about globalization, ideology, and the left, plus the cultural theorist Stuart Hall on media representations and their impact on the media consumer. I'm CS. Lots of thought-provoking commentary coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Today's program features two segments. First, we'll present part two of an interview with Manfred Steger, who argued in the first part that a rising global imaginary has destabilized traditional political belief systems and thus transformed the ideological landscape. Second, you'll hear how the cultural theorist Stuart Hall analyzed media representations and their effect on people who rely on those representations for knowledge about the world. In other words, the effect of media representations on all of us. We begin with Manfred Steger, professor of global politics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and the author of numerous books about globalization, ideology, and the history of political thought. In the first part of the interview, previously aired on Against the Grain, Manfred Steger suggested that we are in a transition from a political and social imaginary rooted in the nation-state and toward a global imaginary that recognizes and elaborates on people's sense of interconnectedness on a planetary scale. This global imaginary has spurred Manfred to use the term market globalism in place of neoliberalism, and also to put the ideas and practices promoted by the global justice movement, the global left, under the rubric of justice globalism. I asked Manfred Steger about the European right-wing xenophobic populism of groups like Marine Le Pen's National Front in France, and the extent to which such formations present a challenge to the current dominant ideology, which many call neoliberalism, and again, what Manfred calls market globalism.
I think they certainly present a challenge, and I would add that this right-wing, what I would call national populism, also is alive and well in the United States. If you look at people like Donald Trump or if you look at people like Ted Cruz, I think, you know, we have our own Marine Le Pens, unfortunately, in this country as well. And what I think the challenge consists of is very simple. These are the voices of the past and in many cases still of the present, because the nation state is not yet disappearing. The national imaginary has not evaporated. I said we are in a transition phase. You could call it almost a sort of an interregnum, an in-between. And that means that the national imaginary is still alive and kicking. Now, as a matter of fact, if you push the national imaginary and threaten it, it'll be even kicking louder and screaming louder and kicking harder. And that's exactly what's happening. Globalization and the rising global imaginary is a real threat to people who are quite happy with living in a world that consists of these national bubbles, and they want to be in their national bubble. They want to have, let's say in the American case or in the European case, they want to have their national culture, and they don't want that global popular culture to infiltrate. So what they are basically representing is the national imaginary. And the national imaginary is now threatened. And every time you threaten somebody or something, you can get a reaction that is very, very strong and vigorous. And that's what we are seeing in Europe. That's what we're seeing in the United States. That's also what we're seeing in other places in the world, whether you turn to Africa, whether you turn to some places in South America, in Asia, National populism is very strong, and you would expect it to be strong. Again, why am I saying that? I'm saying that because it sounds like it's paradoxical. If you're so much in thinking about the global imaginary and globalization, then aren't we leaving the national behind? Well, it's a slow process, and it's a struggle. That's the subtitle of one of my books, an ideological struggle. And that struggle, I expect to go on for this entire century. I don't think that we will really find out what's happening until, you know, decades from now. But in the meantime, national imaginary and national populist parties and voices are still going to be powerful and prominent.
But do you think it's inevitable that eventually the national imaginary will fully leave the picture and the global imaginary will have predominance, preeminence?
No. I do not think that anything is inevitable. I think that as human beings, obviously, there are certain kinds of structural dynamics that are so big and so powerful that very often we feel we don't really have any agency. But we're also agents. We can also change. Same-sex marriage is a wonderful example of how society can change. Nothing is inevitable. Nothing is etched in stone. Nothing is irreversible. So in that sense, I think it is possible that the forces of national populism could become so strong and so powerful that, unfortunately, they cause a major crisis. It already happened once in the 1930s with the rise of fascism and national socialism. The world was seeing what it thought it would never see again after this carnage of what they called the Great War, World War I, a war that will never be repeated, everybody was saying. It was repeated. It was repeated because of the emergence of new ideologies and because of the old still resisting the new. That's the story. So it could happen that, you know, might be sliding into another major crisis as a result of these nationalist populist forces becoming very powerful.
There seems to be at least one major obstacle to globalism of really any category that you've been describing as an effective, not just ideology, but as a practical programmatic factor in today's society and on today's planet, which is coordination, right? I mean, it's hard enough for people within one nation to agree on something or to push something forward. And then we're talking about different nations and regions and, you know, people and societies that have different policy preferences and religions and cultural assumptions and social beliefs. I mean, let's just take justice globalism on the left. It would just seem to be such an enormous obstacle that you have all these different forces on the left in different countries with different opinions and disparate backgrounds. How could globalism on the left proceed in any kind of organized or effective manner?
I think you're asking me two questions, and I'm happy to answer both. I think the first question really has more to do with, how do you actually get the coordination going worldwide? And then I think your second question was really more about, is it possible for justice globalism or the left to really get their act together globally? So, you know, if I want to answer the first one first in terms of this coordination problem or the coordination question, that has always been there in human history. We have faced the same problem of coordination. Say, I'll give you an example, feudal Europe, right? The idea that there will be large nation states that would be coordinated enough with 80 million or 50 million or 60 million people in it was, say, in the case of Germany that consisted of 300 principalities, in the case of Italy that consisted of dozens of principalities, even in the case of France that consisted of various regional kinds of, you know, aristocratic principalities, was unthinkable. And people asked exactly the same question. How are we going to coordinate this? There's so many different princes. There's so many different dukes. There's so many different societies, different languages, different dialects, different cultures. How are we ever going to get it together? I think the answer is, human beings, as social beings, are very good in institution building. So they built institutions, ultimately, that allowed them, and I think education is playing a major factor in this, to actually get that kind of political, social, economic coordination that allowed for the viability of these large nation states. I think the same thing can happen on a global level. We can get institution building in terms of global governance. We even already have institutions that 100 years ago didn't exist, like the UN. And the UN may not be the institution that's eventually going to survive on a global level, but there are many other institutions that we can think of that are already becoming very powerful. The WTO is a good example of a global institution. It serves the purposes of market globalism, but it's global nonetheless. So that leads me to your second point about the global left and how they can get their act together, or could they even get their act together. The point is institution building. The left, just like the right, has to do what human beings always have done in order to be politically effective and change societies, change the world ultimately, is they have to be good at institution building. And I think we're seeing that on the left also to some extent. There is, this wonderful huge area called global civil society, right? In other words, the society of non-governmental organizations, of Doctors Without Borders, which is my favorite organization. They already are operating in a global way. They're already coordinating things. Last year, when Ebola broke out in West Africa, who were the most effective people right there at the very beginning? It was organizations, NGOs out of global civil societies like Doctors Without Borders. It was not national governments that were effective, which again shows you that it's possible for the left to kind of dive into this global civil society, create new institutions that challenge other global institutions, and ultimately, hopefully, what we will see is the emergence of a truly democratic, participatory, egalitarian society that is facing all the global problems that are challenging us today together in different ways with different kinds of solutions and different kinds of proposals. But the idea that global coordination can happen might become reality in those institutions.
And Manfred, your work focuses on global politics, political theory, global political economy, and global studies. What's global studies?
I think global studies is a very exciting transdisciplinary initiative, a transdisciplinary field of study that's emerging in universities around the world. And what makes me so excited, thinking even about global studies, is the fact that these programs actually have mushroomed in the last 10 or 15 years to the point where we now have 300 global studies programs in various universities and colleges in the United States. And it's a global phenomenon. It's not just here in the United States. It's happening in Australia. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in major ways in Asia, in Japan, in South Korea, in China. Now, global studies is more or less focused on the study of globalization in all of its aspects, in all of its domains and dimensions. In other words, it is a transdisciplinary way of looking at our global world today, no longer through the lenses of a particular kind of discipline, but actually look at the dynamics, the global dynamics of the world becoming a more interdependent, a more connected place. So global studies is then organized around research questions and courses that bring together subjects out of, say, economics, like transnational corporations, but link them to issues that usually are not talked about in economics, say, culture, popular culture. How does that work? So, for instance, how is it possible that a relatively unknown rapper in South Korea all of a sudden ends up with 1.5 billion hits on YouTube, his Psy's famous Gangnam Style, right? There's the economics, there's the cultural side of things, there's even a political dimension in all of this, certainly an ideological dimension if you want to talk about market globalism, and also, I think, a communicative dimension, in a sense that this is something that appealed to an enormous number of people around the world. So global studies then looks at this kind of interdependent, globalizing dynamic as it cuts across those various disciplines, and it wants to understand this new global world as it develops. So there's, I think it's not a surprise that it's very popular with a lot of students. So, for example, at the University of California, Santa Barbara, which is perhaps the pioneering institution in global studies in the country today, there are now over 1,000, CS, 1,000 undergraduate majors in global studies. University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, 800. And you can go down the list. It's very popular, I think, because students no longer want to be kind of pigeonholed in terms of national or regional preferences, even very often in terms of fields that used to be very popular, still are, let's say women's studies or Chicano studies. But more and more students would like to pursue their particular interests, but in the context of a more general, a more global framework. And that's what global studies really allows them to do.
That's Manfred Steger, a political scientist based at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. His books include Globalization, A Very Short Introduction, which has been translated into 18 languages, The Rise of the Global Imaginary, and Justice Globalism, Ideology, Crises, Policy. I'm CS, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We turn now to the late great cultural theorist Stuart Hall, a pioneer in the field of cultural studies and the founding editor of New Left Review. Among the questions that Stuart Hall investigated were, what is the role of the mass media in society? What should we make of media representations of things, events, and commodities? And how are the messages conveyed by the media connected to power, to how power operates in society? In a video produced by the Media Education Foundation, Stuart Hall describes what representation in the context of the mass media is and how it operates. The video is called Stuart Hall, Representation and the Media, and it's produced and directed by UMass Amherst Professor of Communication, Sut Jolly. Let's go now to audio portions of that video. Here is Stuart Hall.
Our culture is saturated by the image in a variety of different forms. The image itself, whether moving or still, and whether transmitted by a variety of different media, seems to be, to have become the privileged sign of late modern culture. And late modern culture is not only that culture which one finds in the advanced industrial, post-industrial societies of the Western world, but because of the global explosion in communication systems, it is also the saturating medium, the saturating idiom of communication worldwide. The word has a kind of double meaning, even in its common sense understanding. It does mean to present, to image, to depict, to offer a depiction of something else. And the word representation or representation does sort of carry with it the notion that something was there already and through the media has been represented. Nevertheless, this notion that somehow representation represents a meaning which is already there is a very common idea, and on the other hand, one of the ideas that I'm going to try to subvert. So I give you the common sense meaning to try to take it back a little bit in what I'm going to say. But then there's another understanding of the word representation, which also plays a role in what we bring to this topic, because we speak of political figures as representing us in some way. We don't probably say that very often these days because we may not think they represent us very well, but they're sort of supposed to represent us. And in that sense, they stand in for us. They are our representatives. Where we can't be, they can be. So the notion of something which images and depicts and that which stands in for something else, both of those ideas are kind of brought together in the notion of representation. Now, what this idea that the media practices, among other things, represent topics, represent types of people, represent events, represent situations, what we're talking about is the fact that in the notion of representation is the idea of giving meaning. So the representation is the way in which meaning is somehow given to the things which are depicted through the images or whatever it is on screens or the words on a page which stand for what we're talking about. And if you think that the meaning that it is giving is very different from or a kind of distortion of what it really means, then your work on representation would be in measuring that gap between what one might think of as the true meaning of an event or an object and how it is presented in the media. And there's a lot of very good work which is in media studies, which is exactly like this. I think the truth is that in cultural studies now and in a great deal of media studies work, that notion of representation is regarded as too literal and too straightforward. And the reason for that is because we want to ask the question of whether events, the meaning of people, groups, what they're doing, etc., whether these things do have any one essential, fixed, or true meaning against which we could measure, as it were, the level of distortion in the way in which they're represented. Suppose one says, yes, I can see that people are meeting now in Northern Ireland to discuss the Northern Ireland situation. But what it means, what is the meaning of that meeting, is a very complicated thing to decide. You'd have to know not only the whole history of what led up to it, you'd have to know what each of the participants wants out of it, you'd have to know some assessment of what the consequences of that event are likely to be before you could say, what is the meaning? And we all know absolutely clearly, the one thing you can be certain of is that there will never be one interpretation of what is going on in Northern Ireland today. It will always be a contested question. There will never be a finally settled, fixed meaning. The one thing you can say about those events is that there is no one true fixed meaning about it. Well, now, this is a different situation. In a way, what we're saying now is that representation doesn't really capture the process at all, because there was nothing absolutely fixed there in the first place to represent. Of course, there was something. People are meeting, they're talking, they're arguing with one another, they're going to take decisions, consequences will follow. So not that nothing is happening in the world, but what is dubious is what is the true meaning of it. And the true meaning of it will depend on what meaning people make of it. And the meanings that they make of it depends on how it is represented. The meaning of an event in Northern Ireland does not exist until it has been represented. And that's a very different process. Now we're talking about representation, not as an after-the-event activity. It means something, and then the presentation might change or distort the meaning. We're talking about the fact that it has no fixed meaning, no real meaning in the obvious sense, until it has been represented. And the representation, since they're likely to be very different as you move from one person to another, one group or another, one part of society and another, one historical moment and another, just as those forms of representation will change, so the meaning of the event will change. Now, what this means is, in fact, that the process of representation has entered into the event itself. In a way, it doesn't exist meaningfully until it has been represented. And that, to put that in a more highfalutin way, is to say that representation doesn't occur after the event. Representation is constitutive of the event. It enters into the constitution of the object that we're talking about. It is part of the object itself. It is constitutive of it. It is one of its conditions of existence. And therefore, representation is not outside the event, not after the event, but within the event itself. It is constitutive of it. If cultural studies was simply about trying to understand the distortions which the media make of a meaning whose truth we could somehow find independently of the media, it would be a very different kind of study from what it is in fact, which is trying to find out how the meanings enter into the event themselves, how they help to constitute the event. And this, what we're talking about is really why in cultural and media studies of this kind, at any rate, the notion of culture becomes a primary force. It's not a secondary element, but it's a primary element. Culture is a way in which we make sense of or give meaning to things of one sort or another. It's true, of course, that we all don't make sense of things in the same way, and therefore that each of us has a little kind of conceptual world of our own, or rather we have our own sort of take on the conceptual world. But if we shared no concepts together with other folks, we literally could not make sense of the world together. We could not build a social world together unless we were able to make sense of the world in broadly speaking the same ways. Cultures consist of the maps of meaning, the frameworks of intelligibility, the things which allow us to make sense of a world which exists but is ambiguous as to its meaning until we've made sense of it. So meaning arises because of the shared conceptual maps which groups or members of a culture or society share together. And that's a very important kind of way of coming to an understanding of why, in cultural studies, if you privilege the notion of representation as giving meaning, you are making culture a very central. You're giving it a kind of central role. Yes, it's not just sort of the values and things which we happen to have been born into. It literally is the ways without which we would find the world unintelligible. What are the shared conceptual maps? That's to put it another way, to give you another way into this notion. What are the ways in which we classify and organize the world? Because classification is not the only, but one of the principal ways in which we go about giving meaning to things until we know roughly what class of things it is. Roughly what it belongs with, and roughly what it's different from. Chairs are like stools because you sit on them. And both of them are different from tables which you put things on, although you can also sit on tables. And so our systems of classification are very complex, but without some notion of this belongs with that, that is different from this, we wouldn't be able to have a conceptual map. We wouldn't be able to map out the world in some intelligible way. Now, where do we get that from? Well, the one thing you can be certain is that though the capacity to use concepts and to classify concepts in this way is a biological or genetic phenomenon, it's a feature of how we are constituted as human beings, the particular classifications that we use to classify out the world meaningfully is not printed in anybody's genes. It is something which is learned. It may not be learned in didactic ways at school or in colleges or through instruction, formal instruction, but to become a human subject is precisely somehow to learn or internalize the shared maps of meaning with other people in your culture. One could say then that the conceptual maps in our heads which allow us to come to a sense of what is going on in the world is itself a system of representation. Our concepts are a way of representing the world. You can think of that in a very simple way. I mean, you know, bear in mind an object which you cannot see. Now, unless you had a concept of it, it would disappear the moment that the object had gone from sight. But concepts allow us to store and indeed to refer to and to think about quite complicated thoughts about objects which are no longer accessible to our perceptual apparatus. So So the concepts allow us also to think about a wide range of things which are not in any simple sense out there in the world. So we're beginning to dissolve now any simple-minded notion that our concepts are just mirror images of the world out there. They're also mirror images of worlds that don't exist.
That's the voice of Stuart Hall, the pioneering thinker, cultural studies scholar, essayist, and racial justice campaigner. You're listening to portions of a talk Stuart Hall gave at the University of Westminster in London. The talk was recorded and produced by the Media Education Foundation. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In this next segment of Hall's talk, he refers to football, by which he means, and this will make things clearer, by which he means the game that people in the U.S. call soccer. Here again is Stuart Hall.
So our concepts operate as a system of representation, but we haven't finished the circle yet, because suppose we all shared the same conceptual map, that's to say we made sense of the world in roughly the same way. And we classify those concepts. We have the same system of classification in our heads. How would I know that you are making sense of the world in anything remotely like the way in which I am? I can only know that if you could in some way express or communicate the sense you are making to somebody else. And that second move requires that the concepts find their way through language into communication. We've not talked about communication yet, but you see, the question of communication and language completes the circle of representation. First of all, there's the shared conceptual maps or cultures that we inhabit, but very closely associated with that are the ways in which different languages, and by language here, of course, you know, I mean a very wide range of things. I mean the language that we speak, I mean the language that we write, I mean electronic languages, digital languages, languages communicated by musical instrument, languages communicated by facial gesture, languages communicated by facial expression, the use of the body to communicate meaning, the use of clothes to express meaning, anything in the sense in which I'm talking about can be a language. By that I mean it gives sign to the meanings that we have in a form which can be communicated to other people. Language externalizes, it makes available and accessible as a social fact, a social process, the meanings that we are making of the world and of events. And it's at that point that representation really begins to take off. One of the things which people who've gotten to this point without sort of understanding where they're going suddenly want to say is, oh my goodness, are you telling me that there is nothing but language, nothing but discourse? The only thing that exists is meaning. And this is a very common complaint. It sort of occurs, for those of you who teach media studies, in about, you know, the middle of the second term. Really, it's my view. That's about the point where students suddenly shake their heads, wake up, and say, it's nonsense, you know. There are lots of things in the world apart from meaning and language. How do you trap me into this sort of language box, this language circle, you know? How do you get me into this circle anyway? Then let me try and make a very simple distinction about, you know, about two statements which sound as if they're exactly the same, which in my view are absolutely different. The first statement is, nothing meaningful exists outside of discourse. I think that statement is true. On the other hand, nothing exists outside of discourse. In my view, that statement is wrong. The statement, nothing exists outside of discourse, is a sort of claim that, as it were, there is no material existence, no material world at all, no objects out there. And that is patently not the case. But to say that nothing meaningful exists outside of discourse is a way of summing up what I think I've been trying to say to you. As far as meaning is concerned, you need discourse, i.e. the frameworks of understanding and interpretation, to make meaningful sense of it. And I'll try to give you an example. Round, spherical, rubber or leather object is a ball. Is it a football?
Well, you need a round spherical object to play football. But it's only football in the context of a set of rules about what you can and can't do with the ball, which the ball didn't make up. You have to make up. So the ball only, which is a physical object, only becomes meaningful as a football within the context of the rules of the game. It's only when you develop a game or a language game about football, you can put it there, you can't put it there, you can't touch it, you can't kick it, etc. Within the rules, it becomes a football. So it's meaningful as a football only in the context of the use and the meanings with which it is invested. The notion that meaning is important doesn't require us to deny that human beings have a physical existence, that objects have a physical existence, that we live in a material world which is governed by the laws of the physical world, and so on. It doesn't require any of that. The question of discourse and of frameworks of intelligibility is about how people give meaning to those things, how they become meaningful, not how whether they exist or not. Without language, meaning could not be exchanged in the world. That is the position that I would take. Without language, and I use language here in the broad sense, or I'm reminding you, different media using different sign systems, etc. But nevertheless, without language, no representation. Without language, no meaning. I want to take an example in which some of the ways in which people in culture studies and media studies have tried to explore this process of the production of meaning, how they've tried to get into what we call the practices that produce meaning. And that idea, incidentally, is a very important one, the notion that the production of meaning is not therefore something that just happens because the world is already fixed out in its meanings, which don't change. The production of meaning means that there is a kind of symbolic work, an activity, a practice which has to go on in giving meaning to things and in communicating that meaning to someone else. And it is that practice of the production of meaning, the practice of what are called signifying practices, practices that are involved in the production of meaning that media studies is concentrated on. The effects and the products of signifying practices, practices that are carrying meaning and that in our world happen to be widely circulated by the media being one of the most powerful and extensive systems for the circulation of meaning, although one ought to always remind oneself that the media are by no means the only means by which meaning is circulated in our society. I mean, you know, the most obvious way is in actual talk and conversation with other people, in personal communication. But of course, we are right noticing that to see what happens when systems, complicated institutional systems with complicated technologies, then intervene and take the place of face-to-face, person-to-person communication and exchange, and the means of circulating those meanings become very widespread. Because, of course, the question of the circulation of meaning almost immediately involves the question of power. Who has the power in what channels to circulate which meanings to who? But it's why the issue of power can never be bracketed out from the question of representation. I want to remind you of an image both on television and in the press and in magazines. The picture of Linford Christie at the end of the Olympics with the Union Jack around his shoulders after his victory in the 100 meters. What would you say is the meaning of this image? The captain of the British Olympic team is black, but he's British because he's got the Union Jack, and if there's any signifier left apart from John Bull and British beef, the Union Jack is it as a signifier of what being British is. So somehow, this person, who isn't what one thinks of normally as the majority cultural identity and ethnic identity or racial identity of the majority of British people, because the majority of British people, though the word British doesn't carry within with it any specific reference at all to questions of race or color, one assumes that the British Olympic team might be full of white British people, and here is somebody who's obviously not. Now, this meaning manifestly has to do with the relationship between what you expected to find in the first place, which is nowhere visible in the image, contrasted with what actually is in the image. And this is a simple way of saying what is sometimes expressed in very complicated form, that absence means something, signifies as much as presence. That what signifies is, of course, what is marked, what is in some way visibly there and has been drawn attention to. So the fact that he's black, the fact that he's a winning athlete, the fact that he's carrying the British flag, all those things are marked, but the meaning is not simply in those things, but it's in them insofar as they subvert our expectations, the expectations we brought to them, which nobody has said anything about at all. But nevertheless, as if in this empty open field, the very marking of him as black and British has invoked that which is not said. But what is not said is as important to what is said as the things that are actually in the picture. That every image that we see is being read in part against what isn't there. But a second interesting thing might be the question, well, there is Linford Christie. He is the captain of the British Olympic team. He is a winner. He is claiming something about being British because he's wearing the flag, but he doesn't look like what you would expect the majority of British athletes to look like. What is going on here? Well, part of what is going on is the second thing, which is a kind of claim, a kind of identity claim, a claim of who the thing is or to what does it belong, is made in the way in which it is invested in the practice of representation itself. So that Linford Christie may not know anything at all about identity politics, but nevertheless, for the whole thing to make sense, there is a kind of claim on recognition as a certain kind of person. And, you know, you may think that this is far-fetched because this is a very special example. But just think about advertising. No advertising image could work without being associated with it, a kind of claim on identity. This is the sort of object which those sorts of people in that kind of setting or in that sort of mood are likely to use and wear. So the whole range of visual imagery does come with a kind of identification tag linked to it. Now, I moved, you may notice, from the word identity, an identity claim, to identification. And what I'm asking in the case of an advertisement, say, is what is the degree to which in some way you can project yourself into the image so that you can place yourself within the field of what is being represented to you? Most advertising works by attempting to win identification. And if there's no identification going on at all, you know, if you say, I don't know what it would be like to feel like that person. I've never seen anybody like that. I can't imagine myself ever being like that, etc. Even in my fantasies, there's no identification at all. It's very difficult to, you can get the meaning in a kind of abstract way, but the meaning doesn't begin to register. It doesn't begin to make a kind of claim on you. It is trying to construct a position of knowledge or identification for the viewer in relation to what has been depicted in the image. Now, we know that about advertising. It may be more difficult to see in terms of illustrations in the newspapers about events of faraway places. But even there, unless there's something in the picture with which you can even imaginatively or imaginarily identify, very difficult for the meaning to pass. But insofar as you pause and you stop and look, it has arrested you. It has said, something for you here, something for you here. What can you then get out of the image? You can only get something out of the image if you position yourself in relation to what it's telling you. But what has only we've only gradually come to see is the way in which the viewer is himself or herself implicated, especially where the visual image is concerned, in the mode of looking, implicated through the look at the image, in the production of meaning through the image. It is not that the image has a meaning. It is, as it were, in the relations of looking at the image which the image constructs for us, that that meaning is completed. You might say the image has a whole range of potential meanings, but the meaning which you as a spectator takes depends on that engagement, psychic and imaginary engagement, through the look with an investment in the image or involvement in what the image is saying or doing. So that whereas we have a notion in the way in which we talk about images, that images flood us and barrage us with meanings, as if we can stand outside of them and allow them to, you know, to be there. The fact is that if we're concerned about the proliferation of images in our culture, it is because they constantly construct us through our fantasy relationship to the image, in a way which implicates us in the meaning. And that is what is, in a sense, bothering us. We're not bothered because we are barraged by something which means nothing to us. We are bothered precisely by the fact that we are caught. We do have an investment in the meaning which is being taken from it.
You are listening to portions of a talk given by Stuart Hall, the prominent and influential cultural theorist. Hall directed for many years the Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies in Birmingham, England, and he was the founding editor of New Left Review. He later became a professor of sociology at the Open University in the UK. We are presenting portions of a talk by Stuart Hall that is featured in a Media Education Foundation video produced and directed by Sut Jolly, UMass Amherst Communication Professor and Executive Director of MEF. The video is entitled Stuart Hall, Representation and the Media. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we return now to more of this talk by Stuart Hall.
Suppose you said, I look at this athlete, but I don't see any of the meanings that you are telling me I should see. What can be the answer to that? One potential answer is, well, of course, you're not looking right. you need a course in cultural studies to know how to look at it properly. Then you'll be saturated by images and meanings. But that's not I'm not going to retreat to that that dodge. I'm going to say that that is because the image has no fixed meaning. It has potentially a wide range of meanings. And consequently, the task that we are involved in is a task which many methodologies in cultural studies, like formal semiotics, for instance, did try to make into a kind of scientific study. So there would be some way of proving that this was the meaning of the image which everybody would take. And if only we could have got as scientific as that, the question of meaning would have been resolved. And that was impossible because there is no escape from the fact that meaning is, in the end, interpretation. It always shifts from one historical setting to another. It is always contextual. Only within a certain context can you say, that seems to me to be a stronger meaning than that. We can have a debate about meaning in representation, but it is a debate about which is more or less plausible reading of an interpretation of an image. What we cannot say, that is true and your reading is wrong. And if in this field one succumbs to the illusion of believing that one can climb out of the circle of meaning and somehow reach for the final scientific proof which will hold the image still, you have only to wait 5 days, 2 days, 3 days, talk to somebody else, go out of the room and come back in, you know, and the meaning is on the slide. It has shifted on you. You can't, the things that you thought were important don't seem to be the things that are marking anymore. Things that you thought you hadn't seen, you now see. Someone else will say, oh, I see it differently. There is absolutely no escape from that contestation over meaning. Now, let me put that around another way. Does that mean that, you know, that all the meanings are just float around? Everything means a thousand different things, and you can get into proliferation, a wonderful formal, what the French call jouissance, a kind of, you know, quasi-orgasm of meaning, just more of it, you know, as much of it as you can get, the kind of pleasure of the image. Well, yes and no, yes and no. Now, the meaning can never be fixed, but if you want to say, even provisionally, well, I sort of think it means this, you have got to stop it. You've got to fix it. You've got to privilege that meaning for the time being. May not be forever. You may take it back tomorrow. But meaning depends on a certain kind of fixing. On the other hand, meaning can never be finally fixed. So what we're looking at is a practice which is always going to be subverted. And, you know, the purpose of power, when it intervenes in language, is precisely to absolutely fix. That is what we used to call ideology tries to do. It tries to say, I can tell you what the meeting in Northern Ireland today means. That is what it means. It doesn't mean anything else. It's not going to change. Tomorrow it's going to mean the same thing. It aims to fix the one true meaning. And the only hope you have about power in representation is that it's not going to be true. That tomorrow it is, somebody's going to make a slightly different sense of it. Meaning is going to come out of the fixing and begin to loosen and fray. And therefore, it's not a sort of, you know, postmodern playfulness which insists on the relative openness of the meaning. It is absolutely central to a historical notion that meaning can be changed. It can only be changed if it cannot finally be fixed. Because you bet your life that the attempt to fix it is why power intervenes in representation at all. That is what they are trying to do. They want, as it were, the relationship between the image and a powerful definition of it to become naturalized so that that is the only meaning it can possibly carry. Whenever you see that, you will think that. Whenever you see those people, you will assume they have those characteristics. Whenever you see that event, you will assume it has that political consequence. That's what ideology tries to do. That's what power in signification is intended to do, to close language, to close meaning, to stop the flow.
That's Stuart Hall. We've got a link on againstthegrain.org to the video, Stuart Hall, Representation and the Media. Stuart Hall, a prominent cultural studies scholar and leftist critic, died in 2014. And this is Sia, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State?
February 2nd marks Groundhog Day, a truly unusual event given that the lowly groundhog is the only animal with an American holiday named after it. More surprising yet, groundhogs are rodents. There's no special day set aside for any other rodent. No Muskrat Day, Pygmy Shrew Day, or Bog Lemming Day. It's amusing when Punxsutawney Phil in western Pennsylvania and Jimmy the Groundhog in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, miraculously emerge from their hibernation on February 2nd at the precise, instinctual time when the TV cameras begin to roll. But these photo ops must bewilder the poor groundhogs, which normally wouldn't come out of their hibernation in midwinter, even if the temperature hit 60 degrees. Groundhogs do, in fact, synchronize themselves to an internal clock, but not one on the wrist of a newscaster. Instead, the groundhog's clock is wound in harmonious rhythm with green vegetation, which is only available for a little over a third of the year. Groundhogs eat prodigious amounts of grasses and herbaceous greens, including garden and farm produce, which places them on the most wanted list throughout their range. But greens don't store well in moist underground chambers, so the ingenious groundhog evolved the notion that, rather than storing food underground for winter, it made more sense to store the food internally in rolls of fat. In nature, obesity doesn't often work well as a survival strategy because it compromises speed, agility, and defensive strength while making one particularly attractive to predators. But groundhogs have learned to fatten up very quickly right before they hibernate for the winter, a big belly being the greatest defense against starvation while hibernating in a safe den for 6 months. A groundhog chooses to spend half its life slowly starving while in hibernation. Groundhogs typically enter their den in early October, block the passage with soil, and then coil into a ball with their head between their forelegs and their tail wrapped around their head. Their heartbeat falls from 75 beats per minute to 4 per minute. And their temperature plummets from 90 degrees Fahrenheit to 38 degrees. For 6 months, groundhogs effectively become a cold-blooded animal and would appear lifeless if you could observe them in their dens. Groundhogs enter hibernation weighing on average about 10 pounds and awaken thin and weak, having lost nearly 40% of their weight. In Wisconsin, the winter will almost certainly last well into March or April, so no matter what newscasters say about seeing the groundhog's shadow, it's way too early for groundhogs and spring to awaken. Be patient. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to the Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.